Most heartily welcome. I would like to especially welcome our presenter for today, Mr. My apologies, Dr. Vasu Gogan from Accord. Speak about a dog and a minister. Somebody who went to a doctor's house, a doctor, academic doctor, at the Indian University of Limpopo, called Teflon. I'm looking for Mr. Malachi. Then he called his son. He called his son, Dr. Gowden, said, "This is Mr. Malachi. This is Dr. Malachi. Who do you want?" The son was 5 years old. Yeah. Now, colleagues, let me just come. Let me just want to tell you, I just want to give a short context. Now, colleagues, you would remember that we had said last time, not necessarily the last committee meeting, that in view of the fact that South Africa pursues an Africa-centered foreign policy, and in view of the fact that South Africa is deeply involved together with other countries, sometimes the EU, sometimes the USA, sometimes within the AU, in various peacemaking, peace building, peace enforcement, peace making, peace implementation, and all manner of attempts to make sure that there is peace within the African continent. Now, we have said that from time to time we will invite scholars to make presentations so that we can engage with those presentations, so that we can deepen and heighten our understanding of the nature and sometimes the genesis of such conflicts within the African continent. I think that is what we also said we will do. Now, I'm happy that Dr. Vasu Gowden is able to be here with us, and their organization is very aptly named, Accord, which means African Center for the Constructive Resolution of Disputes. Very good name. African Center for the Constructive Resolution of Disputes. And of course, we will request you to give as broad a context as is possible about this particular challenge of the absence of peace and or presence of conflict in the African continent, but with a special concentration on Lesotho, special concentration on Burundi, is very topical, as well as South Sudan. President Nkurunziza. I just could not pronounce his name. Now I can. Nkurunziza. Chef Nkurunziza. Yeah, I want to know a few issues about him and his country and organizations there, and the peace prospects there. And of course, President Salva Kiir and the other belligerents there. I'm not sure if I'm correct to call them belligerents. Rick Machar and others. What are the issues around the country? And then, of course, we'll allow members to engage the presentation. We will then identify other topics for the future with reference to other specific countries. You could be the same organization that will come and present, or we'll get someone else to present. But it is important for a member who are serving in the committee to be ahead of everyone else within parliament when it comes to matters like this, matters international, matters within the African continent. Maybe we'll also take a discussion about investment. How far is the African continent growing economically? Or this absence of peace, how is it going to affect the fortunes of trade growth or economic growth, things like that. But of course, I'm not saying you could strictly discuss one thing outside the other. You may latch into some of this. And then with that, I want to invite Dr. Golden to present to the honorable members and officials. I don't think there's anyone who needs a special introduction. So, Honorable Kalyan, is there a point of before?
It's a point of order.
That I'm not aware of.
It's a point of order in terms of item 3, adoption of the agenda.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much.
I would like to add an item to the agenda, please. It's the sub judice rule and the issue of al-Bashir.
Okay. In fact, thank you very much. In fact, I have forgotten to go straight to the agenda because I needed to invite apologies so that they can be recorded. Can I get the apologies?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I've got apologies from Honorable Kajede, Honorable Mbumluana, Honorable Kenya, who will join us a bit later. He has gone to his daughter. And Honorable Bergman and Honorable Mukhala. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you very much. Can we speak to the apologies? I think they are noted. The apologies and the reasons thereof are noted. And then with regard to the agenda before us, I've already spoken to one item to it. And then Honorable Kalyan would like to insert an agenda item. What did you say it is?
The sub-judice rule and the presentation by the Department of the Elder
Chief. Sub-judice rule. And then President Al-Bashir. President Al-Bashir, what?
Last week, the presentation was held over.
Yes.
Because the minister said it was sub-judicate. But yesterday in the House, the sub-judicate rule or matter was clearly dismissed. And if you'd like to talk about
No. We'll come to the item. Don't worry. Thank you very much. Any other item to be inspected? Can I hear the House on the item presented by Honorable Kalyan? Our member? Okay. Item agreed to. Dr. Gowden, over to you. Thank you very much.
Chair, Honorable Member, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me back. I don't know whether it was a bad presentation or not, so you decided that I should come back and you could catch me a second time. Usually, if you fail an exam, they give you a second chance. So let me start firstly by not correcting you, because you're correct. I am not a doctor.
My office has repeatedly indicated I have a master's degree in law. I have been admitted to the Supreme Court for the last 20 years or so. We were very good lawyers, I hope so. It didn't help the Honorable Sheila Kota from remaining out of jail when we were his lawyers. But I suspect the law was totally against us at the time.
I have to say you weren't the only victim. I once had my very close friend, a bosom pal of mine, who happened to have been my vice president when I was president of the SRC during the state of emergency in 85-86. And after practicing law, he was being sought by the police. I was given an assurance, if you remember Major Miles in Durban, that they would interview him and release him. And we had had that arrangement with the security police for many of our clients, so I promptly took him to Sial Swat Kwe and handed him over to Major Miles for the interview for the 2 hours or so, and I waited, and 2 hours later Major Miles came back with out my colleague, and I said, "Well, Major, where's my client?" And he said, "Oh, Mr. Gandhi, I'm sorry, you know, I had finished with your client and as I was coming down, one of my colleagues indicated they needed him." Well, I think it must have been a long interview. It lasted 6 months. In Redville prison, of course. He has never forgiven me for that, and he's also seeking compensation. So I don't know. So just a correction for the future. No, I'm told I have an honorary doctorate, but I'm told that you can't use that, and I don't like using it anyway. You have to be careful these days with the titles. I'm quite happy being a good lawyer, dealing with this. But people always tend to make this mistake when they do press. They suddenly assume that you must have a doctorate for that. So what I wanted to do was to go back to the previous presentation just to contextualize what we had done the previous time, and then from there we can go to the present presentation. No, I forgot. Is the presentation up? Yes, it's back. Okay, you have many presentations, yeah. Okay, I'm going to just skip all of these. Okay, just to start here. So I will go back just to recap, so we'll take a few minutes to do that. You will recall that I had mentioned the last time Africa's potential, 60% of the world's uncultivated arable land, 23% of Africa's land area is forest, 75% noble platinum deposits, 50% of diamonds and precious stones, 50% chromium, 20% gold and uranium deposits. So this is of course global total. By 2030, about 40 African countries will be oil and gas producers. Proven oil reserves, 120 billion barrels, worth 7.3 trillion. Proven gas reserves, worth $3 trillion. Proven shale gas, $6 trillion. Pan-African fish trade, $22 billion. And their consumer spend, $680 billion in 2013. In 2030, it will be $2.2 trillion. So that shows that there's huge potential on the continent. The challenge, of course, is how to harness all of that potential. Now, where are the problems? What is it that holds us back from doing this? And what I've been asked to do today was to look at essentially insurgencies on the continent. And then to focus on Lesotho, Burundi, and South Sudan. So what I want to do is to start with looking at what are the structural problems that are causing all of these conflicts that prevents us from achieving the potential that we should be achieving. Okay? So
If we look at society, and this is what I presented the last time, society moves in a linear fashion. Agricultural society, then industrial and information, and now we're into a new era of quantum physics and all of that, where there will be new discoveries, new things that will be happening. I told you about 3D printing, etc., etc. And then prior to the agricultural age, we were in the Stone Age. Now, there are two things that move society in that trajectory. The first is technology, and the second is demographics. So, as demographics change and populations increase, people tend to move. The second is, with the advent of technology, we are able to move into new industries or new areas of economies. So, to move from the Stone Age to the agricultural age, it happened with the discovery of iron ore and the fact that you could fashion implements and you could start to do agriculture at a mass level. The advent of the steam engine allowed us to move from here to industrial society, because with the steam engine you could now build factories, you could power things, you could produce at a mass level, so you moved into that. The advent of the microchip allowed us to move into the information age. And now with new discoveries in quantum physics, with space and time, you will find that in the next decade or two decades, you will move into huge number of new discoveries. I had dinner with my son last night here in Cape Town. He's studying at UCG and he's doing computer engineering. And he's in his second year, so I asked him what he was planning to do when he completes his computer engineering degree, and he said there is a new course called space management, and he wanted to go into space management. Well, of course, obviously I didn't know what he meant, but it's about managing companies that will now be developing new technologies for space travel. So he wants to go into space management. Well, I encourage him in doing that, but that means he's sitting here in this part. So, and he's got a group of colleagues who are studying mechatronics and all sorts of things, and they're all sitting in this area here. Okay, so that's moving society forward. So that technology and demographics are the two things that move society forward. So if we look at technological trend, rudimentary equipment allowed us to plow the land and to do agriculture at a mass level. The steam engine allowed us to go into the industrial age, the microchip into the information age. Nanotechnology, which is micro technology, allows us to go into biotechnology. So the fusion between biology and technology now, and all of the new discoveries that we will have, particularly on medicine, which will provide us with huge new opportunities in the medical field. And then, of course, quantum computing allowing us to go into new frontiers on space. So this is really where, and each period creates new opportunities for employment. So in order to be here, of course, it requires a much higher skill than to be here or there. And this is something that will also define our own continent, etc., going forward. Now, when it comes to demographics, which is the other thing, because the land mass of the planet does not increase, but the number of people per square meter increases on an ongoing basis. So the statistics indicate that in 1950, there were 2.5 billion people. Now, it took about 1,000 years for humanity to reach 1 billion people. It took 100 years to go from 1 billion to 2 billion. To go from 6 billion to 7 billion, it took 12 years. Okay? So just think about it. 1,000 years to go to 1 billion, but from 6 to 7, which is another 1 billion, it took 12 years. That's the exponential growth of the population. Now, it's very good for you if you are investing money, because the magic of making money is in compound interest. It works in the same principle as population. compound interest works on exponential growth. So when you put money in and you invest money, the money grows with the interest, and then the next round grows with the interest, and it carries on. So it's exponential growth. It's the same principle on population. Unfortunately, there is not the money that's growing, but it's the populations that are growing at a rapid rate. So we're talking about 2.5 billion in 1950, 230 million in Africa, 9% of world population. 2015, today, 7.3 billion on the planet, 1.2 billion in Africa, with only 16% of the population of the world. In 2050, we would be 9.5 billion on the planet, and 2.4 billion in Africa, we would be 25% of world population. By 2100, we will be 39%. Almost 40% of all people on the world, on the planet, will be living in Africa, on the continent. Now, it can become a huge burden for us, or it can become a huge opportunity for us, because 50% of these people will be young people. They are the people that will be able to move into these industries and give us the workforce that we need to be a very prosperous continent. The Europe has a opposite problem. They have an aging population. And Asia and some of the other parts will have the same problem. An aging population, which means that they will have a double-edged problem, the first being that they will not have a workforce. So they're going to be battling for a workforce for all sorts of jobs that they have to do. And the second, they would have a huge healthcare problem. They have to take care of a lot of old people, social services, medical services, etc. So this is a problem they are looking at in the future and saying, how will they deal with that problem in the future? Our problem is a different problem. We have a lot of young people in the future, but we also have huge potential. The problem is there are other structural deficiencies. If we don't resolve that in the next two decades, we are going to have serious problems also. So technology and then the population. Now, if we look at the demographic trends, and you will look that populations are getting more dense. So we have more people per square meter in the continent. A 0.8 person in 1950, 80 persons in 2050. Okay? Countries like Burundi and Rwanda are already overpopulated. Countries like the DRC are underpopulated. So there will be that kind of balance. Of course, in terms of population size, there's currently only one African country in the top 10, that's Nigeria, in terms of population size. By 2030, there will be three African countries: Nigeria, the DRC, and Ethiopia. Nigeria has enormous structural problems already. And DRC has even more structural problems to deal with. So how they will manage those populations going forward becomes a huge challenge. Ethiopia, under Prime Minister Meles Zenawi, has a huge plan. And if you go today to Ethiopia, I have been going there from 1993. I've been there all of 20 years, and I've seen the rapid development in Ethiopia. Highways, freeways, in fact, their housing projects are actually much better than our own housing project. They have good cluster units, modeled very much on the Singapore cluster units, etc., and they're spreading them out and building them. But they have a huge problem. They have about 75 million people, and a large percentage of them are young people. So they've had this, of course their infrastructure doesn't come anywhere near matching our own infrastructure, but they make rapid progress in 20 years in terms of the construction of their infrastructure. Many people think of Ethiopia and they think of famine. That's the main image that people have in their minds of Ethiopia. But if you go there today, they've already have Gauteng launched and the facilities already in the center of Addis Ababa. It's going to be the longest metro rail in Africa. So they're making significant progress, but that doesn't mean all the countries are. Africa has under 18 population, 1 billion by 2050. Okay, that's a huge number to deal with. But it's a huge opportunity, because it means that we will have masses of young people who can drive the growth of the continent for at least 2 to 3 decades. They can start the industrial economies, they can start the information economies, they can take us into space, all sorts of things. It just depends how we manage that. With the influx of young adults, voter demographics, interests and perceptions will also change. So you're going to see a lot of changes in the next 2 decades. By 2050, Africa will have a larger urban population than rural population. That, if we don't industrialize, will become our biggest problem. Because urbanization without industrialization means you are going to get millions and millions of young people flocking into urban areas with no prospect of employment, putting pressure on social services, housing, sanitation, water. So these are the problems that we will be facing going forward if we don't correspondingly create new economies. And that's why I think both the AU and our also SADC adoption of the industrialization frameworks are extremely crucial. How to finance it, how to operationalize it will become a challenge, of course. But that we have to industrialize goes without saying. There's no other choice that we have. If we are going to move into the information economy, into the space economy, then you're going to have to skill up kids like my young son. You have to send them and get them skilled up in computer engineering and all those things. So we're going to have to shift the emphasis away from BA degrees to science and technology degrees, to business science degrees. So the priorities would have to shift. It doesn't mean every young person has to become a computer engineer to enter that field. The technicons will play a major role because, you know, the computer engineer is at the high end of the chain on this computer computing era, but there will be many jobs for technicians. And that we can fill up again having technicon around the continent. It was one of India's successes in entering the information age is that when they closed off India under Nehru, they rapidly built technicons. They just built thousands of them all across the country, and they were skilling up a lot of people in IT without really having a sense that IT at some point will boom. And when the IT boom came, they literally had thousands and thousands of these army of young people who were skilled in IT that allowed them to dominate the software industry in the world and export these young people all around the world. So it was by chance that they managed to do it. So here again, we have to prepare ourselves for the future to say, how do we begin to skill up people and move in that direction? Now, if we don't do all of that, what you're going to get, I'm going to just skip this. Let me just go quickly back here. What the two things does, what new technologies and the movement of people do, is they change the nature of society. With technology, there are two things that are happening. Technology allows for the globalization of the market economy. So it allows money to move across borders without reference to borders. Okay? So governments can't really prevent money from moving across borders. That's why your currency can be destroyed so easily, because of globalization of market economy. So I gave the example the last time of a company like Nokia, which was hosted, its home country was Finland. But Nokia had a higher revenue than the GDP of Finland, simply because Nokia got its revenue from the entire world. It sold telephones throughout the entire world. So its revenue came from the billions around the world, whereas the revenue for the government of Finland came only from those 5 million in Finland, the tax revenue. So even though it was able to tax Nokia as a company, Nokia's revenue was much higher. So if you take today Microsoft, Google, Uber, who just started, the revenue is much larger than most small countries. And what that means is you've seen the rise of private enterprise and the decline of nation states. There is a statistic that indicates that of the top 100 economies in the world, measured by GDP for countries and revenue for companies and GDP for countries, 51 of those economies were private companies and 49 were countries in the top 100. That indicates the change in nature between the private companies and the state. The second is globalization of information. The fact that we have all of this computing power now just on this little instrument, and we can do all sorts of things with this little instrument. It means also that it has put power, enormous power, in the hands of individuals. So I'm sitting here talking to you, at the same time I can mobilize millions of people around the world by just pressing a single button here and just highlighting some issue and get millions of followers around the world. So it has, the globalization of information and the globalization of the market economy has changed the power relations between private enterprise, nation states, and civil society. A lot of the role of the nation state has become privatized. Education, healthcare, housing, security, they're all now privatized. So that the state becomes reduced to an entity that creates the enabling environment more than provides all of the services in that environment. So these are the changes that are taking place, and we have to be alive to those changes, because all of those changes affect how we see the future and how we will, the future will be determined. Now, if you look at those three sectors, what you require, and I'll explain why this is important in the context of conflict on the continent, because not all of this is happening on a continent uniformly. Some of it is happening, some of it is not happening. And what you see here as the rise of private enterprise, rise of civil society, and decline of nation states doesn't happen uniform. It's not happening in Burundi. In Burundi, the state is still all-powerful. In the DRC, the state is still all-powerful. In many countries on the continent, the state is still all-powerful. So we have to read this situation very well. And this is sometimes where our colleagues in the north, when we have debates with them, we say to them, you are seeing the continent through these lens. This is what is happening in your part of the world. This is not necessarily what is happening in our part of the world. And so the context is very, very different, and we'll come to that in a short while. So what do you expect to see in a nation state? When you look at the state, private sector, and civil society, there's a distribution of power and influence across the three sectors, okay? The state should be made up of political parties based on values, whatever values those are. The state has a monopoly on violence, generally. So the state has a monopoly on, and should have a monopoly on, the security agencies, but they should be professional and under civilian accountability. And then there should be a segregation of powers, so yourselves as the legislature should be separate from those in the administration and should be separate from those in the judiciary. So those who make the laws should be able to have oversight over those who administer the laws to make sure they're administering it in a fair and just way, and the judiciary should be able to test that they are doing it in that way. Okay? So that's in terms of the state. In terms of the private sector, we should have a sustainable, independent, and diverse private sector. It shouldn't be a single commodity private sector, oil or diamonds or whatever. You must have a diverse private sector. You need good infrastructure. Commercial infrastructure, a banking system, financial infrastructure, physical infrastructure. You need all of that for a active public sector, private sector. And then you need a regulatory environment to ensure that there's predictability in the environment. And then you need a civil society that's independent and strong, well-resourced, and represents diverse interest groups. Political parties are also part of civil society, by the way. Trade unions are part of civil society. Soccer clubs are part of civil society. So there should be a strong civil society. Now, if you have all of this in society, you need two other things to make this work. You need skills, and you need resources. Okay? So that's where stability comes from. And you will see as we go forward now, this is not necessarily what is present in all of the countries. So let's take Burundi, where we have serious problems right now. It has a semblance of this. The political parties are still based somewhat on identity, not on cross-cutting on values. The security agencies are under military accountability. And the separation of powers, there is somewhat a separation of powers, but you will recall that recently on the third term issue, it was said that the president was able to manipulate the constitutional court. So you've got that blurring of lines in there. Civil society is very much politicized. So it's not about soccer clubs and all of that. It's just politicized civil society. The private sector here operates because of government, not despite government. So it doesn't operate on its own. It operates because you are linked into the government. Okay? The country has a huge deficit of skills. And it has a huge deficit of resources. That is a recipe for continued conflict. That's why we're not able to come out of the conflict in Burundi. And you're going to see the consequences of that now as we go forward. Not just for the country, but for insurgency and all the rest of it. Okay, so this is what we need. Now, if I take ourselves here as South Africa, we have pretty much all of this present. And we have resources. We are not a country that is depleted of resources. I mean, by all accounts, even if we look at our debt to GDP as a nation, our debt to GDP is at an acceptable level. It's not at a critical level right now. So our economy is by no stretch of the imagination sitting in an intensive care unit. It is still a functioning economy. There's some things we have to tweak going forward, etc. So resources are there. Our private sector operates despite government. Tomorrow the government shuts down, don't shut down the private sector. The private sector will continue. But here, for me, our critical problem is here. Skills to manage government on the one hand, skills to create new economies, in the industrial economy, the information economy, skills in the education sector, having teachers who are at the level where they can teach kids that are today exposed to these kinds of instruments. Kids today are much brighter, much sharper. They don't want to be taught in the traditional method. They want to be more creative. So, and the teachers are in a different age and era, and the kids are in a totally different age and era. So how to manage this thing, this becomes our problem. So going forward, this is our problem. But we have all of this in place. And that's why, for me, if people ask me as a conflict management specialist, what is my prognosis for the country going forward, I'm not pessimistic about the country. But I want to be vigilant about how we manage and mitigate conflict going forward. We will experience a lot of conflict going forward because we look at the latest statistics that came out of the World Bank report yesterday or the day before in terms of young people. We will see that we are going to have a lot of young people. We have growing unemployment. So we have to do something very quickly in the next decade at least so that we can manage this problem. But for us, it's still a manageable problem. Now, a distribution of power and influence among the three sectors. Now this is labor statistics. In Europe, generally in Europe, 40% or so of people are in the public sector, 30% in the private sector, and 30% in the civil society sector. What this results in is a manageable population, so they go from 750 in 2025 to 732. So your population is decreasing and becoming more manageable, though it's an aging population. Life expectancy is high, urbanization is high, so it helps them with industrialization. Infant mortality is low, TB, HIV, AIDS is low, malaria is low, and then sanitation is, use of sanitation 99% on both urban and rural GNP per capita pretty high, and the population living on the poverty line pretty low. Okay? Now, here where we come on a continent, our big problem is a concentration of power and influence at the center, almost uniformly across the continent. What that is resulting in is people on the periphery that sit here are marginalized. We're seeing a rapidly increasing population, 2025 1.4 billion, 2050 2.3 billion. We have a small urban population, but it's rapidly urbanizing. It will be 50% in the next 2 decades or so. The problem is that that urbanized group is not at the same time in an industrial economy. They are in no economy, basically. Life expectancy is dropping, infant mortality, TB, malaria is still high, HIV, AIDS, etc. And then if you look here at sanitation, urban 42%, rural 23%. Coupled with that comes attendant diseases, etc. And then 65%, 65% of people living under the poverty line. That is a big problem for us going forward. Now, if we take South Africa, you'll see that there's 59% of us in the private sector, 18% in the public sector, 23% in civil society sector, which includes universities, NGOs, all of them. But that's only 30% of us. In fact, the number is increased. It's increased. We've increased slightly to around, I think we're around 34% or so. So, but we still have a large number of people that are sitting on the periphery. And these people are largely in the agricultural economy. But not commercial agricultural economy. They're in subsistence. So even if they, you see the trick is, when you get urbanization, you will still have a large rural land mass. But that will be few people doing commercial farming. And the bulk of your people would move into urban areas involved in the industrial and information economy. And that's how you will become a productive nation. But if a large percentage of your people are sitting in a rural area in a subsistence agricultural economy, so you are not producing to sell, and you still don't have the people at the center also. This becomes a problem. Now, and I'll show why politically this also becomes a problem. Kenya, 60%, 28%, 12%, but that represents only 20%. And then Burundi, 61% in the public sector, 35% here, 4% here, but that only represents 5% of the people. Okay? So here's the problem. When we have elections in Burundi, and this is what we try to explain to our colleagues from the north when they come in and say, change the government in Burundi. In fact, we had a lot of difficulty explaining here in South Africa also. Third term, all of those things are fiction when you come to a situation like this. It's not so easy to say, take a South African legal framework and how we operate and all of that, then you come here and tell them there is a constitution and a third term. It doesn't work like that. Here, our problem is, for people who are sitting here, generally, they have skills and capital and access to opportunities. These are three very, very crucial things. Skills, capital, and access to opportunities. Now, it's a very controversial topic here in South Africa also. But one of the largest empowerment initiatives ever undertaken was between 1948 and 1990, Afrikaner Empowerment in South Africa, where it was a systematic engineering of three things: skills, capital, and opportunity, to counter what they suffered previously under mainly English rule. Now, those things to engineer are generational things to do. It takes a generation or two before you can reap the result of that kind of engineering. So what was that engineering from 1948 to 1990? In terms of skills, it was the building of universities, it was re-equipping of schools, the building of schools. So you started at a primary and level. So if you go and look at what was done in that period, particularly with our Y compatriots during that period, the schools that were built. I mean, the first rate schools. I remember myself living in Overport, growing up where, you know, the school that we had didn't have a proper soccer ground. We played everything on the same ground. Then Hartley Road, just above the border from where we were on the other side, had a swimming pool, had a rugby field, had a soccer field. They had a proper school, good uniform, I mean good desks and laboratory and all of that. So that kids could be educated from the primary level, secondary level. Then the creation of Rand Afrikaans University, all of the new universities to counter those old Natal University and UCT and the traditionally white English-speaking universities by the creation of Afrikaans universities. And that was re-engineering of skills for that period of time. Of course, we go to UWC and UDW and UNITSA and all of those other things, but not at the same level that you had, you know, where we were all squeezed in a few little places in Goya and all of that. So the first was the engineering of skills. The second was the engineering of capital. Polskas, Panlam, all of those big institutions of capital that were created to give access to capital. And the third was opportunity. So the Job Reservation Act, where those adverts, for those of us who were growing up there, some young people at here, they would not remember that when you look at the employment column, there used to be a line that said whites only. That's engineering of opportunity. So there was a systematic engineering of those three things. Skills, capital, and opportunity from 1948 to 1990. Now you have to look at re-engineering that. The people that sit on the periphery don't have skills, they don't have access to capital, and they cannot take advantage of any of the opportunities that exist or that will be created in the future. Their only way of gaining access to that is to be in municipal government. It's a way of getting access to resources. It's a job, it's a salary. So when you have elections here in the center, and you people lose elections, you can move to something else. Because you have skills at the center, you have access to capital, and you have opportunities. You can become a professor in a university, you can join an NGO like a court, Aziz Fahd is senior political advisor in a court. Veliran Slapo is senior political advisor in a court. You know, I see Mafumadi is a professor at the university now on leadership, University of Johannesburg. So everybody who's here, you lose elections, you have somewhere to go, you have skills, etc. But for the people that are here, if they lose everything. They lose their job. And that's why the battle for positions here is such a vicious battle. That is the reason. Now translate that into Kenya. That's why we have all these problems in Kenya. Now come to Burundi. In Burundi, if you lose in the center or the country, you lose everything. That's why you see the problem in Burundi. This is a structural issue that relates to the problem in Burundi. If you are president here, you lose. That is your finish. You're out of everything. You're a minister here, you lose everything. I meet with some of the ministers. They're very insecure people. Because they never know what's going to happen the next day. And, you know, so they will fight tooth and nail to keep it. That's why we are seeing assassinations left, right, and center. A coup that was staged, people were killed. The president's right-hand men, generals, assassinated, taken out with two RPG rockets and semi-automatic gun barrels. 3 days later, human rights activists attempted assassination, landed in a hospital. 2 days ago, a former Tutsi general, high ranking, taken out. Now, we are going to the inauguration next week. We are fear what will happen in this small, short period between today and next week. There's going to be a lot of things happening on the ground. This is the problem. This is the problem. So even third term and all that, that people raised, you know, the president and the third term, we had the opposition leader. This is in Cortes. You don't have Cortes here also. You know, Mr. Oh, you do. No, these are facts. But, no, but it's good you must report about these problems so people are vigilant, they know what to do with the problem. But obviously I can't compromise confidences of discussions we've had since we're not in committee. So, but this is the problem that we are dealing with, and that we're dealing with in a place like Burundi. So you have got this as the structural problem going forward. And now I want to move in that kind of direction. So if you take Sweden, and this is where when we sit with our Swedish colleagues, we said, but look, you can't now look at this situation and then think it like this. But it took them a long time to get here. It took them decades to get to where they are under a hegemonic party, of course, the Social Democrats, with huge investments in education that started in the 60s and even before that, and then they reap the benefits of that, and now they're a very innovative society, etc. So we are moving in this trajectory. And sometimes you will find that we might go back this way. We, like Burundi, is going back that way now, instead of going this way. And what we have to do is to continuously mitigate these situations. It is going to take the continent to realize all that potential that you saw at the beginning. At least a decade or two. We are making significant progress. So if you go to Burundi right now, you will see a hard road from Bujumbura going into Kigali to Tanzania, etc. There are railways being built, there are roads being built, there are ports being built, there are dams being built. The Ethiopians have built one of the largest dams, financed entirely by Ethiopians, contributions from the public, called the Renaissance Dam, the Dam the Nile River. It will provide them with huge energy, but it's, you know, that energy they will be able to use to industrialize Ethiopia, because you need energy for industrialization. So there are many things that are happening, but those things don't happen in 1 year or 2 years. It takes time for that infrastructure. If we are going to put a dugout port in KwaZulu-Natal, that is going to help us to move more ships in and out of the harbor at a faster rate, because we are one of the busiest ports. You can't think of a port today and tomorrow you have the port. You think of the port today and 10 years later you will have the port. So these things take time. I was in a discussion with the president of Sierra Leone, where they have a serious problem with fresh water. Now, I sit on the Umgeni Water Board, and I've been on that board for about 10 years. I understand how water works and what it takes to build water facilities. We are currently building a dam in Durban. The plans are there for the building of the dam, but it's going to take us until 2022 to build it. It's a huge project to build. It's going to cost us about 80 to 20 billion to build the dam. But it's necessary for our growth in the future. Now, when the president said he needs a dam, but he needs it, and I said, president, you know, it takes about 5 years to build a dam. He said, I don't have that time, because I've got people rapidly moving into Freetown, and we don't have enough fresh water. And I said, well, then you have two choices. One choice only. If you can't build it in 5 years, is to raise the dam wall, so that increase the capacity of the existing dam. But that is easier said than done, because if your substructure was never built for raising the dam, you raise it, you collapse the whole dam. So these are challenges. They, you know, when people look at it and just say, why are you not doing this? These are challenges that you are facing. And our job as conflict management specialists is to look at the scenario and say, what's the realistic thing that we can do? The realistic thing is to mitigate conflict whilst the development takes place. Whilst the dams are being built, whilst the ports are being built, while the roads are being built, while the industries are being built where we can drop all of these young people, etc., etc. So the next decade, 2 decades, on the continent, we have to brace ourselves for intense conflict. It doesn't mean that we won't be prospering as a continent at the same time. We will be moving ahead as a continent. But we will have a lot of conflict around that time. Here in South Africa, we have to accelerate the re-engineering of skills, capital, and opportunity. Those 3 things. If we don't re-engineer that skills, capital, and opportunity, and it is not something that could have been achieved in one generation. Not with the backlog we have. And the challenge for us is that time is running out, because every year your population grows exponentially. If your re-engineering of skills, capital, and opportunity and your development does not grow with the same curve, but that goes in that direction and that goes in that direction, that gap is your conflict. That's your conflict potential. So we have to make sure whatever we do going forward is we keep it at the same trajectory. So that's really what I wanted to say was the problem. Now, I'm not going into this because this is what we covered the last time. Now, I want to switch to the presentation on insurgency. So this is just to indicate to you the structural problems that we are facing on the continent. And why, now when you look at insurgency, there's this breeding ground for insurgency all over on the continent, because we have these structural problems and weaknesses, and so we are going to continuously see a resurgence of that. While they're getting the presentation up, I think one of the questions you will have to answer is, as a portfolio committee dealing with international relations, to what extent do we balance our domestic priorities with putting money into peacemaking on the continent? Because there can be the public outcry that, well, we have got all the problems, housing, healthcare, etc., etc., which requires money, our economy is not growing that fast, to meet all of those needs, then you are taking money and putting it in the DRC. And you're putting money in Burundi and in all of these places. And these people are just fighting, and they're continuing to fight, and we're wasting our money, and we're spending all our money. This will be an issue in the public. So I'm glad the reporters are here also. Because a few years ago, when we, as a country, underwrote a lot of the DRC conflict at some city, you will all recall that we spent that time in some city. There was a there was an outcry about the fact that we are paying for all the people who are gambling in Sun City and dragging out the negotiations and all that. And why are we spending all this money when in fact we should be putting the money in our own country? The same issue arose around attacks that took place on foreigners in KwaZulu-Natal recently, that they are a burden to us, they are creating a lot of problems, etc., etc., etc. Now, let's look at it objectively. When I went to President Matira, who was then the facilitator, because we spent those 45 days at some city with President Matira working with him on the DRC conference. And I said, Ray Matera, you know, this is the problem that the South Africans are talking about, all the money being wasted. And he said, you know, Basu, the amount of money that your companies will get out of the DRC will make this money pale into insignificant that you are spending here in San Francisco. And it is true. The amount of revenue that our mining companies, our telecoms companies, our services companies have since got out of the DMC makes that money pale into insignificant. Now, you might say, but those are private companies. They are taxed in South Africa. And that is revenue that comes into our tax coffers. So during the violence on foreigners, I had to also go to our colleagues on national television to say, but look, you know, we get a lot of our gas from Mozambique. We get a lot of our oil from Nigeria. MTN, largest revenue is from Nigeria. All that is tax money coming here. So these people are not just a burden to us. We derive a lot out of those economies. So when it comes to peace and security, we do not have a choice as a country. In as much as we are prioritizing our domestic priorities on housing and etc., we have to, of necessity, we have to invest in peace in the rest of the continent, starting with the SADC region. Because our economy and the growth of our economy depends on stability in a SADC region. There is no way anybody can argue that we have to disengage from the continent. It would be the wrong thing to do. So that is something that we have to get clear. That is something we have to do. So looking at, let me stop here and ask if there are any questions at this stage before we move ahead on insurgency.
No, I would rather advise that you proceed to look at, because you've generally looked at the causal factors and the genesis of a conflictual situation and perhaps the emergence of insurgencies, whether they generate from internally from the because of particular circumstances and or they may be externally driven because of competition for the same resources of that nation state by a foreign country. Whether you want to latch into that, that's a different matter. The point is, if you could concentrate on Lesotho, Burundi, and South Sudan, on the absence of peace, on the rise of insurgencies there, the manageability of etc., then we'll allow members to make their comments. I'm looking at the time now.
Yeah. Okay. So, these are the three things that are driving a lot of the conflicts on the continent. Inequality, poverty, and unemployment. And we've looked at it structurally how that arises. And it has to do with skills, capital, and opportunity. Okay? Now, the second place, so the first had to do with inequality, unemployment, and poverty driven by lack of skills, opportunities, and capital. Are you not able to see it? You're going to get it, yeah? Yeah. I'm giving you all the copies. Okay. Do you want a hard copy? I think I have one copy in my bag if you want it.
No. We will, in that you're saying you have hard copies.
One copy?
Yeah. Let them make copies for the member, but in the meantime, proceed with the presentation. Members can be requested just to note if they want to comment on that thing. Otherwise, we'll run out of time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You'll get yourself copies. The second is the governance deficits that we are dealing with. The shift from single-party states to multi-party democracies was something that we were not completely prepared for on the continent. So that's why we have all these conflictual elections here. The rise of coalition politics, the heightened competition for political power. The continent was not completely ready for all of that development. So political parties had not reached the level of maturity, nor the polity itself had reached the level of maturity where you could have that. Remember that a lot of the advanced democracies over the around the world advanced over many decades, some centuries also. The challenges for political parties, the shift from liberation movement to governing parties, hegemonic political parties, fragmented identity-driven parties in coalition systems. We are seeing that proliferation of that throughout the continent happening now. And then, of course, poor quality of governance and administrative institutions, inefficient policy implementation and service delivery, small and low tax bases, and then exclusive political processes and narrow policy outcomes. So these are all factors that are exacerbating tension and conflict in the various countries that we are dealing with. Okay, here's some of the manifestations. The first is that when people talk about corruption in Africa, corruption only accounts for a small percentage. It is about 10 to 15%. The large percentage of financial issues relate around illicit financial flows. President Mbeki's commission is basically looking at this issue. Estimated cost of organized crime, $870 billion a year. The illicit financial flows, 50% of the value of illicit trade is in Africa. Tax evasion, money laundering, and these are multinational corporations, by the way. These are large multinational corporations. The total illicit financial flows from Africa between 1970 and 2010, $1 trillion. Losses of more than $50 billion a year. That is more than all the overseas development assistance that comes into the continent. So there's more money that goes out than development assistance that comes into the continent. Then you've got transnational organized crime, narcotics, arms trade, maritime piracy, and then of course now wildlife and forest crimes as well. So the logging that goes on, poaching of animals, plants, etc. This is huge losses to the continent in terms of revenue. And in terms of destruction of our ecosystems, all of that that happens. These are, largely, this is not just the continent. This is relating to people from outside. So, I mean, the logging is Thai companies, for example. That's in collusion with companies here. Okay, then you've got the changing nature of governance and civic engagement. We are going to see a lot of that happening as we move into the future, so you're going to see more and more urban conflicts around the continent. This is simply because younger people are now all equipped to this equipment, so they're mobilizing around issues, etc. We're going to see that. The increase in protests globally, in 2006, 59, 2013, 112, 49% of all food-related between 2006 and 2013 were in sub-Saharan Africa. Okay? So the moment fuel prices go up, food prices go up, you will have people in the street. That was what happened in Tunisia, that was what happened in Egypt, etc. Overflow of refugee and IDP populations, again driven by prevalence of conflict, and you will see more than 144,000 individuals left Burundi since April. That's a large number of people. 66,000 to Tanzania, 56,000 to Rwanda, 11,000 to DRC, 9,000 to Uganda. That's a huge number of people on the move without food, putting pressure on countries in the region. And then migration into Europe, 182,000 asylum seekers across the sea from the African continent. Now partly, we say to our European counterparts also, partly the problem of that is Libya. Because Libya has become such a hotspot and so chaotic that a lot of people are moving to Libya into the rest of Europe. And unfortunately, part of the problem of Libya was the fact that they used the kind of strategy that they used to deal with Gaddafi. That has left the country in total chaos. Now, we have been engaging with our colleagues openly on that matter. not to be reported. No, but we have said to our colleagues, American, French, British colleagues, that they were warned not to stir up a hornet's nest in Libya. Even Hillary Clinton, at the onset of the conflict in Libya, said that Libya's social makeup, its anthropological makeup of tribes, etc., is much more complex than Somalia's. And that if we do not manage it properly, Libya will become 10 times worse than Somalia. Libya is 10 times worse than Somalia today. Because if we had gone with an AU plan, which was to manage Gaddafi's departure, we would have been better off today. We would not have all of these factors that we have to deal with. Of course. Of course. It is true. There was a huge interest on oil. And Libyan oil is of a very high quality. Apart from Libyan oil, a large percentage of Africa's water resources stretch from Darfur to Chad up to Libya. So that's a huge water table. So there are many resources that are sitting in that desert. Insurgencies, these are political, radicalized ideologies, and they have an asymmetrical approach to combat. Okay? The asymmetrical approach is not a new approach. Beheading, suicide bombing, all sorts of things are not new. They go back centuries. They've been used every time a people are confronted with overwhelming force from one side and they don't have access to that overwhelming force or sophisticated weaponry, they will resort to the most primitive ways of dealing with it. Because that's what asymmetrical warfare is. And today we are in the middle of asymmetrical warfare. So ISIS is engaging in two things. They're engaging in a conventional war and in asymmetrical warfare. Because what they have is they have conventional capability on the ground, but they don't have air capability. The Americans have air capability, and they're using, of course, the Saudis, the Turks, everybody with air capability. In order to counter that, they're engaging in all of these strategies that you see that shock people. So the idea is to shock. But it's not a new technique. It's been used forever. Now, these insurgencies, they are amorphous and opaque organizations. They're not easy to capture. But make no mistake, they are not ragtag armies. They are highly sophisticated and complex. They are masters of the IT world. So they have young people who are highly skilled. They know how to use and manipulate IT. All of these YouTube and uploading videos and all of those things, recruiting people, moving money along the internet, etc. They have mastered that. Whom do they represent and what are their interests? This is not always clear. This is always the problem. We don't know that. Their grievances are rooted in historical inequalities and they have diverse manifestations and motivations for violence. So it's a highly complex environment that we're working with. The regional and global links, the ideologies, funding and resources, again, is quite diverse. Now, is there somebody planning this thing somewhere in Afghanistan in the mountains and that it's spreading across? It's not that it is happening like that. It's that it is now become an ideology that people have subscribed to. Very much like, and recently we had a discussion with some people, associating this with the evolution of Marxism in the late 18th century, 19th century, etc. If you look at how Marxism evolved, it evolved as an ideology, but it spread rapidly across the world. And it was imbibed by people across the world, and nations were overthrown, and new nation states were created with a particular ideology. It is not outside the realm of possibility that today what we are seeing is radicalized Islam ideology. That radicalized ideology is finding support amongst thousands of people, millions of people across the world. Why? Because it is addressing this question of inequality, poverty and unemployment. It's addressing that question. And whether they have an answer to the question is another problem. But they are addressing that question. I said, whether they have an answer to that is a different issue. But they are providing an ideological home for people who have that problem and who are responding to that problem across the continent. Now, how pervasive is it across the continent? So they're dealing with poverty, illiteracy, high rates of unemployment, poor working conditions and insufficient training and capacities of law enforcement, government institutional weaknesses, poor control of borders, low and insufficient administrative coverage of large territorial expanses. So Boko Haram survives because, one, it has support in the population in the north, two, it has support inside the military in Nigeria, and there is corruption in the military and the police. So it can survive. The same with Al-Shabaab in Kenya. It is thriving on the same issues in Kenya. The proliferation of transnational organized crime, illicit trade, human trafficking, they all go together because it creates a no man's land. In the Sahel, this is what we are dealing with. In the region above Mali, between Mali and Libya, we are dealing with transnational organized crime. We were told that a large aeroplane was landed in the northern desert of Mali, crash landed, simply because the goods were more valuable than the plane. So the plane was crash landed, the goods were taken out, and the pilot left. The goods, of course, was cocaine. So the goods were much more important than the plane itself. Okay, the global trend in insurgency. In 2013, 60% of attacks occurred in 5 countries. Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Syria. And the rest of the world suffered a 54% increase in terrorist incidents in 2013. So there's a rise of terrorist incidents across the world. And these are the figures you see here. The global total is Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, and then here's the rest of the world. The sources of course, global terrorism index. So these are all reference resources that we are presenting here. Again, you will see here 35% in Iraq, a kind of no man's land. You know, they asked Donald Trump the other day, I was laughing when he gave a comment, they asked him about Iraq, what would he do with Iraq if he became president of the United States. He said, there's no country called Iraq. It doesn't exist. He says it's a chaotic place. Now he's right in a way, because it's a chaotic place. Yeah. In certain hotspots on the African continent, you will see the red means that there are severe hotspots. And you can see this belt of instability in the center. From Libya, all of these spots. This is the belt, and then Somalia here, Yemen on this side, and then Iraq, etc. on that side. So here's the hot spots here. Negligible, you can see Namibia, etc. Very low, South Africa, we don't have a major problem here. Medium moving in there, and the high in those countries, and then severe here. So those, as you can see on the continent, we're dealing with a huge area of instability. Now, here's the zone. Libya, Nigeria, Lake Chad, Basin area, Somalia, Kenya, and Mali, Sahel, Belt. So these are the affected areas that you're seeing here. So if you take Libya as the first one, there's disintegration of state apparatus, loss of effective control over territories and militia following the regime change of Libyan leader Gaddafi in September 2011. So Libya is effectively divided into two right now. There's one part that is supported by the international community, the other part is just supported by all sorts of clans. There are a number of tribal groups, all of whom are highly armed in Libya. And they were right, Libya is 10 times worse than Somalia. And remember that Somalia we have been sitting with for 2 decades now, attempting to resolve Somalia. So I don't know that we have much hope in Libya for the short term. Decentralized and localized security forces and armed militias formed along narrow identity markers now compete with one another for power, influence and resources. Example, oil, tax revenue from population, largely accountable by to political structures. So remember that you might wonder how is it possible that you can control a huge thing like an oil rig or something. But they do. ISIS, for example, controls oil in Iraq, between Iraq and Syria. They control those oil bases, and they get revenue of $3 million a day. $3 million a day. So you wonder, but if the whole international community is fighting them and policing them, where are they selling the oil? They're selling it on the black market in Turkey. So this Libyan oil is not difficult for them to sell it. Wherever there are opportunities, there'll be buyers. And remember that the buyers can get it at a very low rate right now. And then they can sell it at whatever they want to sell. And that continues to generate the conflict because it provides the resources to them. There are political negotiations between rival institutions. Consequent decline in human security has contributed to further radicalization of Libyan youth and provided a fertile breeding ground for foreign terrorist groups established foothold. Now the major thing that we are dealing with in Libya is the entry of ISIS in the last couple of months. So whereas previously it was just Al-Qaeda, it was their own Libyan group all fighting amongst each other, we've now seen the entry of ISIS into Libya, which complicates the matter a hell of a lot more. So instability in Libya is accelerating security challenges in the neighboring countries, Tunisia, Egypt and the Sahel region, as well as in the Mediterranean countries, Greece and Italy, due to unrestricted movement of weapons, persons and flow of refugees. The Mali has always had problems, but it has been low scale for a long time. It escalated after the Libya conflict because a number of the Tuareg who had been fighting the Malian government, now going back for decades, were recruited by Gaddafi, armed and trained by Gaddafi for his own purposes. When Gaddafi left, when they were taken out, all of those people were able to move into Mali, back into Mali and restart the conflict. So you've had a huge complicated problem in this region. So you can see in Libya, 400,000 people displaced. Here's Libyan army controlled, here's another controlled area, there's Tuareg controlled area, there's a group called Libyan Dawn controlled area. So it's all different groups controlling different areas, all highly armed with huge conventional weapons. They're not running around just with revolvers. They've got huge conventional weapons and they're all around there. So this is the problems we are dealing with in Libya. The next one is Nigeria. Lake Chad based area. The emergence of Boko Haram finds root in ethnic, religious, developmental marginalization of northern communities of Nigeria, dating back to the 1800s. So that the northern communities, mainly Muslim, have always felt marginalized from the center. They felt cheated from the oil resources, they're more underdeveloped, etc. And that was fertile breeding ground for Boko Haram to have suffered. In its earliest incarnation, it emerged in 2002. And an internally focused movement against perceived Western influence over Nigerian government and society. Boko Haram means reject Western education. That's what Boko Haram means. It says reject. Haram, of course, you know, is haram. It's evil. Evil. So Boko Haram is Muslim. Boko Haram, you know, is reject Western education. That's what it means. That's Boko Haram. So it started out as that. So it wanted to counter Western influence. Okay? So following diplomatic negotiations with former President Obasanjo, he tried, that failed. Now, severe underdevelopment and unemployment in Nigeria's northern states, widespread corruption throughout the military and the administration of the former president, contributed to Boko Haram's enhanced capacities to mobilize young Nigerians and growing military strength. It has also now said that it is aligned to ISIS. But that is probably more to gain more prominent alliances, etc., than it is a total loyalty and allegiance to and I don't think they will want to totally internationalize what they are doing there. Okay, but the duration of the presence has led to massive outflows of refugees into neighboring countries and placed great strain on administrative and security capacities of the late basin. So all of those countries around Cameroon, Chad, etc. You can see here a total death by a perpetrator, state actors, 5,300, Boko Haram, 13,000, Boko Haram or a state actor, 11,000, sectarian actors, 5,000, other armed actors, 1,000, total deaths to 2011, 36,000 in Nigeria, and climbing. Somalia, Kenya, that's the other area that we're dealing with. Al-Shabaab emanates from radicalized remnants of Islamic Courts Union, which controlled South Central Somalia from 2000 until the invasion of Mogadishu by Ethiopian-led forces in 2007. Now let me just say that the conflict started in 1992. Between 1992 and this period of 2000, it was really a no man's land with militia groups fighting for control over small territories in Mogadishu. I went there in 1997 with Professor Jeff Terrible. He was the chairman of our board at the time. And Madiba was asked to come and assist in the conflict resolution in Mogadishu. Of course, Madiba couldn't go because that would have given legitimacy to all sorts of militia groups, etc. But Professor Terrible, being the Director General in the Presidency, and also the chairman of our board, Madiba asked him to go as the chairman of a court, and as a court, but he could take greetings from Madiba so that those who didn't feel that we ignored them and ignored their flight. So it was, that was the strategy that we had used. So we went down there and we spent 5 days, Professor Farewell, myself, and our deputy, Jerome Sashani. And I have to tell you that it was really just an old man's land. The only people who had any semblance of control around that time was the Islamic Courts Union. None of those other militias, IG's militia, Alimadi's, all of those characters that were there, the ones who had control were the Islamic Courts. So why did Al-Shabaab arise? It arose because people saw stability in Islamic Courts Union. They presented stability and people wanted stability. They needed resources, they needed water, they needed water, and this was provided by the Islamic Courts there. That's how Al-Shabaab arose. Of course, now it has taken on a life of its own, it's more radicalized, etc. So Al-Shabaab initially focused on eliminating, again, all external influence and interference from Somalia. Many of you will remember that American movie called Black Hawk Down, when the Americans went in, what happened, etc. Al-Shabaab's ideology rooted in fundamentalist view of political Islam. An interesting thing is happening now in Somalia is the entry of Turkey into Somalia. Huge amount of assistance. They just completed a brand new airport in Mogadishu. In the middle of this war zone, they built a brand new airport in Mogadishu. So you can see that there is entry also of a lot of external forces into the continent in some of these radicalized conflict. So we'll talk a little bit about that also. The African Union peacekeeping force is there. They managed to make some success. So if you look here, amidst of the situation overview here, red indicates areas controlled by Al-Shabaab. That's how much they controlled at the time in January 2014. By October 2014, African Union AMISOM has managed to liberate a number of areas, but they still control some of these areas. Now, they have been operating in a conventional operation here. Now that they've lost territory, they've gone back into asymmetrical warfare. So what they're doing is, because they are not present here in a conventional way, they are using suicide bombers. So you have seen last week or the other week, there was a huge suicide bomb in a hotel in Mogadishu. So they are back on that. They also are recruiting actively in northern Kenya as well. The Mali Sahel Belt, current dynamics in Mali rooted in decades-long contestation between the Tuareg communities for greater autonomy and development in Mali. Now, they, during that fight over those that period of time, they were given a home by Gaddafi. So the most of them went to Libya. And they were armed and trained and used by Gaddafi, and when Gaddafi was overthrown, as I said, they all went down there into Mali, and that's why we saw those huge conflicts in Mali, Burkina Faso, now Niger is going to be affected, etc. Now, the international forces that have been in Mali since late 2012, France, with Operation Sabal, the African Union force, then the UN force that has been there. All offensive forces, because you have to deal with that in an offensive way anyway. And then insurgent groups, a number of them dealing here, Ansar al-Din, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and the Movement for Unity and Jihad. So the problem again is they proliferate into a number of smaller groups, and it's very difficult to deal with them, because you don't know who you're negotiating with, who you should be negotiating with, etc. The groups are increasingly involved in violent attacks that target civilians, local authorities, UN peacekeepers, etc. Okay? That's just the dynamics around there. You'll see it's extremely complicated. Potential and emerging insurgent threats from the African continent, Central African Republic, Uganda, we will see some emergence there. Egypt continuing with the Sinai area, Sudan, possibility there, and possibility if we don't solve the Western Sahara issue, they will go back to armed conflict on the Western Sahara side. I'm going to skip some of this here, and this global analysis. These are in the document, so you can see how the OAU defines terrorism. You can look at ourselves, South Africa, 2004, the protection of constitutional democracy against terrorist and related activities, at 33. And then there are a number of responses from the continent that are again in the document. So I'm not going to go through them. They are just legislature, basically. Now, there are two ways in which we have been responding on the continent. There are military-based responses and dialogue-based responses. There's something that you should know as a portfolio committee. We will be called upon, as South Africa, both on peacekeeping and peace enforcement. This is something we should be prepared for. We have always been doing peacekeeping. The first peace enforcement we have been doing is in the Eastern DRC. And then you remember our troops got caught in combat in the Central African Republic, though they were not there for combat purposes. The question is our readiness for combat in peace enforcement. On the military responses, nationally driven responses, Tunisia, state of emergency and legislation throughout the country to deal with insurgencies, Egypt, state of emergency, legislation in North Sinai, and they have a military response there. Kenya, targeting of Kenyans of Somali descent in northern Kenya as a means of disrupting Al-Shabaab's networks, okay? And continental peacekeeping forces, AMISOM is in peace enforcement, MINUSMA in Mali, peace enforcement, then AFIC here, where we are involved in East DRC, is also an enforcement mission, and then the multinational joint task force by Chad, Niger, Nigeria, again, is also an enforcement mechanism. Realize that enforcement has only been in the last 5 or 6 years. We have not been involved in that previously. International contributions to military responses, French military operations in Central African Republic and Mali, and in the United States counterterrorism activities through proliferation of drone activities, military support bases, and special task force activities. So the U.S. and French troops are actively involved on the continent, also both on training as well as the deployment of drones, etc. On the diplomatic side, these are the difficulties that we are having, how to engage in dialogue with radicalized non-state actors. They are dramatically opposed worldviews and ideologies. So that, you know, where you can, in the DRC where you're talking about state power, there's a lot you can negotiate about. But when you have somebody say, I want to establish a Islamic caliphate, that's it. There's nothing to negotiate about. So they're diametrically opposed ideologies. incompatible demands and asymmetrical warfare, to whom in radicalized non-state actors does one speak to? Are the moderate branches with willingness to dialogue? Do they have a mandate to represent the organization? Do they have influence over the insurgent wings of their movement? And if they reach agreement, to what extent can they keep the adherence and enforcement, enforce their commitment? So this is, these are the problems that we will experience when we are looking at negotiating with them. I'm not going to go through that. How do they threaten our development? The increase in refugee populations across the continent. We continue to see refugee population. You've known what happened in KwaZulu-Natal recently, and we will continue to have more and more refugees here. Strong links to the economies outside the continent and our position as a continental transit hub, and policing and border management challenges contribute to the rise of organized criminal activities throughout the continent and in South Africa. So we will see a lot of these problems and challenges that we will have also. Bear in mind also that our economy is very tied to the economy of Africa. So instability there will damage our own economy here. Greater investment in security-based responses, diverse limited financial resources from other development priorities, so that will be another problem. We have limited resources, how do we balance the two things? And then heightened potential for lone wolf attacks. If we are involved in dealing with insurgencies and the enforcement, we have to expect that they will target us also in the future. So those are also problems that we will have. Bilateral trade will be affected, continued incidents of terrorism, and then illicit trading will take place also. Okay, I'm not going to go here, maybe we can leave it here for questions. The Burundi one, I'm happy to say I know Burundi extremely well, and I'm happy to take all of the issues on Burundi. Maybe I can just quickly go through this. The issue revolves around the Arusha agreement, which was reached, which we as a country were heavily involved in brokering. Arusha agreement made provision for two terms only. A transitional term and one more term. The constitution made provision for two terms by universal franchise. That's the effective clause. The president relied on that thing. His first term, he was elected by, under the Arusha agreement, by the parliament, not by universal franchise. And therefore, in terms of the constitution, he was entitled to two more terms. Those were the legal arguments. The political facts on the ground are very different. So you can go with all the political arguments, and this is sometimes what we have to look at. You can go with all the legal arguments. The political facts on the ground are very different. And reality calls for looking at the political facts on the ground, not just the legal framework. You can go till the cows come home and talk about legal framework, but you have to deal with the political reality on the ground. The political reality in Burundi was that he commanded a majority support on the ground, and his supporters weren't going to allow him to just step down. So what did you have? April to May 2015, 40 plus days of civil protests in Bujumbura, mainly in the capital. Mainly in the capital, not in the rural areas. And his support base was in the rural areas. There was a failed coup attempt, then the election results, parliamentary elections, his party won 77 out of 100 seats, 77%. Presidential elections, he won 69%. Now you may say, but is that the true reflection or not? If I would actually say the true reflection, he had that much support on the ground. And part of the problem with the opposition using the legal avenue was that they knew that if he ran, they didn't stand a chance. So they were using the legal avenue to get him out of power so that they could stand a chance in the election. He was not going to let that happen. So this was a toss-up that we're having. So currently we are in a serious state of insecurity there. For the opposition, a key problem arose after the elections was that this gentleman, Agathon Rwasa, was whom the opposition were presenting as the main challenger to the president. He didn't take his name off the ballot form. He won 18% or something, and he won some seats in parliament, and decided to take up the seat in Parliament. So the opposition felt abandoned by him. Not only that, he then accepted appointment as Deputy Speaker of the Parliament. And that took the wind out of the sails of the opposition. Which goes to indicate that the problem there are not so much principled problems. They're about positions and power. Resources. Okay, so there is a joint UN-AU sponsored dialogue. Currently it's not going anywhere. President Mutreni is the one who has been appointed as the facilitator. He has appointed his Minister of Defense. But this is stalled right now. The government said there will be no negotiations. There's an inauguration next week. The president will be inaugurated and then we'll discuss a government of national unity. South Africa is peacemaking efforts. We deployed a fact-finding defense delegation headed by the former South African contingency commander, General Ngweri, to the AU mission in Burundi. We participated in discussions on Burundi by the International Council of the Great Lakes region. President Zuma was there. Deployed a minister in the presidency as special envoy. He went there. We sent a state security agency delegation led by the deputy minister of state security. Then we participated in the East African Community Summit on Burundi led by deputy president. And then we deployed an interdepartmental elections monitoring team seconded to the South African embassy in Burundi. So we have been quite actively involved as a country, you will see, on a number of fronts. And we currently have a contingent on the ground assessing the security situation also. As a court, we are actively involved also alongside our government in Burundi. South Sudan, constant accusations of human rights violations on all sides of the conflict. South Sudan financial year 2015 budget, $3.76 billion. Budget shortfall, $2.4 billion. And as you can see, they are getting no revenue coming out of oil right now. 1.5 million IDPs in South Sudan, 559,000 South Sudanese refugees in neighboring countries. Circulation and discussion of AU Commissioner Inquiry on South Sudan's reported disputed fact. There has been a Commission of Inquiry led by President Obasanjo, but that report has not yet been implemented. Again, there was an Arusha agreement here amongst the political parties. There's an IGAD process. So there's a negotiation within the political party SPLM, and then there's negotiations between the different rival groups. These are two sets of negotiations that are going on in parallel. The negotiation between the rival rebel groups is brokered by IGAD, essentially by the former foreign minister of Ethiopia, and that is taking place in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa, and then there is negotiation within the SPLM, and that is being broken by ASCCCM and the Ethiopian political party, EPRDF. Our own current peacemaking efforts, that's what I was talking about now, and then South African peacemaking efforts. Deputy President was appointed as President Zuma's special envoy to South Sudan. And there was a lot of subtle diplomacy between Addis Ababa, Nairobi, Juba, and Arusha. The Deputy President made a number of trips. The ties between SPLM and ANC was exploited to look at how we could resolve that. And then South Africa, chair of the AU Post-Conflict Reconstruction and Development Committee on Sudan and South Sudan. So we are involved at that level also. And then South Africa is represented on the ad hoc AU ad hoc committee with the IGAD plus mechanism, so we are one of the countries that have been drawn in to help break the deadlock on the negotiations between the rebel groups, and then we are heavily involved in the political party negotiations also. Lesotho, constitutes a crisis in 2014 requiring urgent intervention by SADC, the deployment of South African police to guard installations and key political figures and promote security sector reform, and then the material facilitation, declaration and security accord. Let me just say that I, last year, as part of Mgeni Water in December, we had our Mgeni Water retreat. We were hosted by the Lesotho Islands Water Project. So I went there for the first time, and we did a tour of the dam. We went inside the dam. We are very vulnerable as a country. Particularly out there. Because we get a huge percentage of our water from that project. I, quite frankly, it didn't look to me that the dam was very well guarded. Now maybe they are guarding it somewhere, I'm not a military man, so I don't know whether they are there. But this is so strategic to South Africa. It's extremely strategic to our country. And I'm not surprised that we would send our police immediately to go and guard whatever installations there are there. So the instability in Lesotho threatens our stability here in South Africa. It threatens our water resources very, very heavily. So we have to invest. The problem is the political makeup between the parties. The political parties are so weak that multi-party democracy is very difficult to have. There's a tenuous political power struggle between the two sides that go from one side to the other. And the ones in the center who can tilt the balance one way or the other are basically will shift from one to the other depending where the power is. So today someone can be in power, tomorrow somebody else offers something else, they go to the other side. So this is a very serious problem for us. The February 2015 general elections, no outright winner of elections. All Basotho Congress, 40 constituencies. The Democratic Congress, 37. You can see how close they are. And so it depends on the coalition. And that's a very tenuous coalition. So there's an environment of increasing political insecurity. Several members of ABC, former government officials, have fled to South Africa. June 2015, the assassination of Lieutenant General Mahao, a suspended former LDS commander. That was a serious problem for us also. So we will continue to see instability in Lesotho. In terms of our own peacemaking efforts, just to end here with this last slide, the willingness to engage flexibly through different points of entry and to consolidate African-led initiatives, bilateral relations, the regional economic communities, and then party-to-party relations. So we operate at all of these levels. There's a desire for South Africa to undertake collaborative approach to peacemaking efforts and to position itself as an impartial stakeholder. We have always had that reputation and will continue to have that reputation. It's something we should try to keep as an impartial broker. There's a clear interest of ensuring stability and promoting the peaceful resolution of disputes and through the consolidation of the country's African agenda. And then the challenges of enforcement in mediation efforts, how to incentivize without coercing. A carrot versus six, which stakeholder within a peacemaking process should be responsible for ensuring compliance. Longer term challenges, continued political instability in countries where South Africa has devoted significant diplomatic and financial resources over the past two decades. Structural underpinnings of conflict suggest that sustained engagement will be required for at least the next two decades. So as a country, we have to prepare ourselves for the next 20 years to be called upon to intervene. We just prepared a paper for DIRCO recently, looking at South Africa's peacemaking efforts over the last 20 years, and they're making suggestions to DIRCO on some of the things we think DIRCO can do. For example, more interdepartmental cooperation between defense, intelligence, and foreign affairs, and then also building more mediators in South Africa and a mediation unit within DIRCO, paying more mediators and using more of our diplomats as mediators. So that's where we are. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. London. Yes, let me welcome the honorable members who joined us after we started. But there are also members who are not full-time in the committee, who obviously had an interest in the presentation that is given to us. Honorable Mezeli Boy is here, most welcome, because Mezeli and honorable Mostala. Honorable Idu Mosala, has he gone out? Okay. And the Honorable Strike Ralekoma, most welcome. And Honorable Kenneth joined us later. We received an apology, Honorable Dudley. Thank you very much. And thank you once again for your very comprehensive presentation about the opportunities and challenges in the African continent. Now, as you were speaking, I was beginning to situate, you know, the fortunes or otherwise of our vision, African Agenda 2063, whether it will arrive there by 2063, given all of these challenges that it must navigate. Well, but at least you've alerted us to the challenges that okay for now. Honourable member, as we usually do, we will invite comments, if you want to make a comment, we invite clarifying questions, and then we'll get responses, and then the next item will be the security rules as proposed by Honorable Kalyan. Honorable Kalyan, you want to have the very first bite over to you, followed by Mayila.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Basu, I'd like to say thank you so much. It was such an interesting presentation,
yeah.
Something that this committee can only benefit from. I have the advantage of representing the South African Parliament at the Pan-African Parliament. So as you were speaking, a lot of what is in under the second day, you know, was quite familiar, and having knowing colleagues in Mali, you know, when the coup was happening, that they were in hiding, having been to Libya, because Gaddafi was at one stage the chairperson of the AU, it just kind of, for me, really jammed, and I appreciated what you had to say. Just a few comments. I mean, with regard to ISIS and Boko Haram, you say one of the main reasons for their foundation would be that their grievance is rooted in historical inequality. But there is a perception that it is religious fanaticism which could be at the root of it, and I'd like to hear comment on that, because although Boko Haram is reject with education, by the abduction of those young girls and their insistence that they learn the Quran and recite it, whether they understood it or not, points in the direction of religious fanaticism. Now, do you think, although the charter, the democracy charter, although it's been ratified, is actually effective, given the rate of what's happening on the continent with, for example, now, with Burundi challenging a third term, I think Rwanda is also going to do that. You also indicated that South Africa may be a target in terms of the terrorist attack. Do you think that we are prepared? Our intelligence the AU has what is called a situation room, and they get, I think, daily briefings on what's happening. Do you think that South Africa is on top of it in terms of intelligence and anticipating what can happen? And then do you think we are capacitated to deal with such a thing? I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mayila. I noticed your first when she came. She came after you.
No, the pirates, especially around the so that the what strategies we need to overcome that. And lastly, how these guys of government, we don't talk to government for things that are talk to NGOs, like the gift of the giver. And when people are asking them, we find that the gift of the giver should be able to
Thank you very much, Honorable Megan. Now we're back to the woman's month.
Thank you very much. I needed to Mr. Vasu. Mr. Vasu, it was a very, very good presentation.
Yeah.
As a committee, we do this kind of presentation. I concur with the chairperson. But for, in order for us, the committee should be empowered with such information because we can't call ourselves as members of international committee, whereas we don't have such information. Thank you very much indeed. But just to comment on your earlier presentation, you said it's a repetition of what you presented some time ago. I was not here. But I think it helps to get a proper information in order to cast it down to what is happening now, currently, in every country. And you also mentioned about your son, that you want to go and study those things. I agree, but I don't know if it has. You look on the broader picture to say in South Africa, education is quite expensive. Your son is very lucky that you can pay for his education. What about the others who come from the poor background? Because the education in South Africa does not take our children forward. I think I just want to comment on this one. On the illicit financial flows, it's becoming a problem. In South Africa, in the continent, of course, we have also alluded to the fact that the UN, through former President Thabo Mbeki, was tasked to go and look at this issue. I think now it's gaining momentum, even on us, because in South Africa, I think it's around 1.3 billion who's living the shores of South Africa. And it talks to the government itself, because you can't even blame government on many instances, because that's this last sum of money that is leaving the country. And you begin to ask yourself, where is the solution on this thing? Because it's eating on us. Even EFF can take power from ANC. It's still going to be a problem. Even DA, even IFP. So it's a common problem that it needs all of us to put hands together and face this thing. It's even worse again at the continental level because of the things. I just want to start on the point. The issue of globalization, whereby you mentioned that there's no role now of the nation state. Because one person, Coca-Cola, for instance, can go to everywhere. Nokia, you made an example of Nokia, that they can go everywhere without consulting the South African government or any government for that matter. They just do it over the computer and then that's it. It's a problematic. You also mentioned that it will take us decades, like Sweden. You even reminded those comrades of Sweden. But when you're comparing with Sweden, there was no conflict in Sweden. Maybe this is the only thing when you compare to other Africans. We can learn from them. We can learn from Korea. We can learn because the main thing is to get our economy correctly. But the main challenge here in the continent is those conflicts. Now you were just talking about Burundi. I would like to know from you the role of the ICC because most of the problems here, our political leadership don't want to leave power because in one instance it's the role of the ICC. Once I'm not a president of a certain country, I know that the ICC is coming after me. So I think, I don't know, you'll share with us with you. Maybe in your role as we are going to all of Africa, how do you support this thing? It must be. I mean, there's some kind of solution to the thing.
Thank you very much. Other takers, Honorable Mota. No, thanks. And thanks also for allowing me to visit your committee. You know, I was a little bit idling after my committee, and I decided to join the international. I just have one question, and I think it's related mostly to the first question asked by Honorable Member next to me here. There's a perception that this time is the time for Africa. Africa is rising.
And that the fact that the West in particular has underdeveloped Africa for centuries, and given that they have benefited from their resources, you know, in all aspects, you know, diamonds, gold, and everything. But these Solanyana groups, you know, Boko Haram and whatever, are actually a creation of the West to defocus Africa from achieving its objective of stability, so that they can continue to plunder the resources, you know, of the continent. Every time when there is an attempt to stabilize, there is something that is actually cropping up, you know, because this stabilization does not work in favor, you know, of the West. If I could just hear your comment on that one. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Musala, Honorable Kenya, your Edward, was it Raputi? Honorable Raputi, there's your mic there.
Yes, but I was listening, but I've got a problem with my eyes. And you said that, you know, if the eyes have any problem, the whole body gets affected. Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation. You know, my concern is about who funds this Boko Haram. Have you managed to get the founder of the movement? Because really, with this Africa Rising and this Boko Haram, and it looks like got more power, because it seems as if they really want to transform the whole Africa, and it's really a threat. And from your background and that, what do you think that Africa can do with this situation, because is this Islamic kind of kind of an issue? And yes, we can see that, you know, on your presentation that Sweden do exceptionally well in bringing the Sweden kind of a model to South Africa. How can we be able to act? Because really, with this colonization and with this apartheid, what it did to South Africa, I think it's going to take a long time. But you can see everyone is trying to position themselves, not really assisting the ANC government to rebuild, you know, South Africa. So what can you really assist? How can you really advise that South Africa should go, you know, the model of Sweden? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kenya.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Apologies for being late. But I think my apologies have been quite.
Yeah, you were delayed. You were told about that.
No, I only have just two brief questions. My first question is, looking at it as a business, but because it's a business, okay.
Well, God did say they shall be complete by the in the proceedings of this committee.
I'm worried about, I don't know what happened. If you did that, then I was explaining what happened to the gas in Nigeria, to the natural gas. You don't know, it's quiet. There are no more companies. You don't know what's happening in our country. So we are quiet. And it worries us, because when you have campaign, you want to know where the campaign has gone, how far the campaign has gone. If you can back to that, then I've noticed that there are so many gaps now in this session. Secondly, just want to check, there are so many peacekeeping forces. I saw your slide, though I don't have to see properly in the document. My third question is that, do these peacekeeping forces belong to participate in the UN Security Council?
Thank you very much.
Honorable the Quarter.
Well, gentlemen, I don't want to overload. I don't want to overload Mr. Gowden with he already has quite a bit of load. But I thought I must make an observation that I think might be helpful. Many of us who come from the politics of the developing world, because perhaps of lack of exposure to the whole continent and even other parts of the world, we may become unable to explain the origins of some of the indigenous resistance formation and begin to think that there is some, well, something, some superstitious theories of our own. The truth of the matter is that even if you take a group like Boko Haram, nobody can just come with money and say to people, here's money, fight the government. There must be in the original a genuine cause for dissatisfaction. Mm. You know, if for instance a corrupt group takes control of the state of a country, the people of who are in that country, some group or tribe, may be so unhappy with that it begins to organize itself. But external forces like in the original, the French, the British and so on, may come and then say to that group, look, you are doing very well by opposing this fellow because it is corrupt, and especially when that group that is in power is not serving the interest of the sponsor. The sponsor a dissatisfaction that in its original has its own indigenous. It can't otherwise be created theoretically. And we must understand that. We must understand that Somalia was one country, but it was various tribes put together by colonial forces into one state. Just like South Africa is now, so many more than 11 formations of tribes put together by the mighty force of the British at the time. And these things are now Kenya as well. And you can find that those things can be used later on to generate inter-conflict. My own observation is going to be both Rwanda and Burundi, you know, which is an experience I've seen with my eyes. Burundi consists of the Hutu and Tutsi, just as in Rwanda. It was a German theory that the Tutsi are different from the Hutu. These people speak the same language, believe it or not. They speak one language. They have one culture. They have married and intermarried for so long. In fact, this name, Hutu Tutsi, they are like saying, these ones sing the elephant, and this ones sing the lion, or something like that. That is what we do here in South Africa. I'm telling you, some Basotho are tall, some Basotho are short, some Tutsi are tall, some Hutu are short. I was in this peace committee in Burundi. So when we started the negotiations to settle it, so I asked these people now, but okay gentlemen, what is the quarrel between the Tutsi and the Hutu? No, you see, actually these guys are tall and we are tall and this, that and that. But you know, they said these things. So then I say, in the same committee, I say, but what are you? No, I am Hutu. I say, but you are tall. And you? No, I am Tutsi. I say, but you are short. How is it possible that now you are fighting over this question that the others are tall and the others are short or something like that? And yet you are actually in the opposite groups as what my teddy is. But that's how they have been told. And when I looked at the ID, ultimately I was shown the ID, I was shown the ID. That ID is written because in the Adi you have Tuzi, no, Hutu, Tuzi, Twan. Because the third group is a very small Twan. So what happens when you take your ID, they give you the same ID. But then you say, now, what are you? No, I am now this. They cancel the other two and leave the other one. You can never, on the streets in those countries, you can't say, that's a Tuzi, that's a Hutu. And the question for me was, how did you get to know who to kill? You have to put the roadblocks and you have to produce your ID, and on the basis of that ID, they killed you. It came from Germany. The problem we had in Ogambo, where Ogambo killed in large numbers and so on, it was German West Africa. The same thing was this German field of differences between tribes. The same as when we had these parties we had in South Africa. Because here in South Africa, the National Party was very, very linked, especially before the Second World War, to the Germans. And this policy of Africans that you are this, you are Bantu, you are Ghana, you are this, you are that, also came from there, and these things led to that. It's important, it's really very important, that we must examine carefully the theories that were introduced among the people of Africa. And that exposure I had told me that the same thoughts of tribal differentiation in the country was the same source that did what it did in Rwanda, Burundi, what it did in Ogambo, in German West Africa, that was German East Africa there, and here influence of Germany into this. So these tribal things, the theories that Africans are not the same, came from that. I just want to say that, you know, we want to forget about these theories that, you know, somebody is telling us, you know, go and fight so-and-so. A friend who has corruption will always fight. There will be differences, and depending on how it is, the corruption levels and all of that, what people see is what moves them to do some of the things.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kota, for your observations. From me, I want to join my colleague, Mr. Golden, for your very good presentation. On Burundi, don't you think that both Africa and South Africa and the world has now a diplomatic nightmare, kind of? Diplomatic nightmare in that, on the one hand, both the USA, the USA, the EU, the AU, SADC and others that don't proceed with the elections, the climate is not good, therefore the elections will not be free, fair and credible. And he went on, President Nkurunziza went on. And then he got elected against the dictate of the Arusha agreement, which has only two terms. And of course, he has made this interpretation. Now, there will be a presidential inauguration. If a president or president attend the inauguration, it means they actually endorse his presidency and will work with that government. It means it becomes a legitimate government working with a legitimate president. You see that kind of thing. Now, I don't know whether they are, what excuse they will use, that, okay, we recognize you will attend the inauguration, but you know, the way you were elected, we have a problem. I don't know, where did they will take. Or is it that they have recognized that in terms of popularity, both the party and the president is so crowded that if you wanted a different product other than him, you would invest in the eyes of the population, would have appeared like wanting to impose your own person other than our person. And our person as a population is Nkurunziza. If you wanted a different product, that's your own understanding. You know, it's like wanting to impose that kind of thing. But I'm just saying, where do you think this thing that now the government is legitimate when you actually did not even send observers? That is the first thing. The second one is whether Nkurunziza will allow for a peace brokering within or by the leadership within the Great Lakes, or within SADC, or within the AU.
because one of the parties is now participating. And of course, you have left the others in the ledge. What are the implications of that? The implications being that, in what we are talking about, that they could then create a legitimate insurgency, in their view, look for sponsorship from outside, undergo military training, and then do what they are doing. Already they have killed Shiri, I don't know what time to pronounce that name, because I'm not going to start saying Shimir, whoever. A very popular guy within the establishment of Nkurunziza. Mm-hmm. And then the one that has been killed last week Friday, I suspect, is from the other side. Mm-hmm. Now that might unleash a prolonged instability in the country. So no sooner would he have been inaugurated than he deals with instability throughout. I don't know. My conference is for discussion, but I just thought you could say something around that. Only so to the question is whether the people who are referring to broker peace there have brought it to the attention of the three major parties, or all of the parties, to look at the architecture of their constitution. Because you see, for quite a long time, the coalition government has been, you have used the word tenor, it's been weak for quite some time. Even now, just if I were just to go to that letter. Tom Taban picked it up that the Deputy Prime Minister Mutezwa and Musisidi, who is a former Prime Minister, were now going to work together, and they were going to unseat him. As they were preparing to go and unseat him, and then suspend the constitution, suspend everything. So then for the next 6 months, there was frustration, there was impasse. Until then, because then there was this change of this military guys, Mahau, and Kamudi. I don't want to get to that. The point I'm making is that there is no guarantee that the coalition between Mutezwa, who's now Deputy Prime Minister, to Musisidi, will work for a long time. Kabane might be in the court, but you see, number two can always go and work with number three to work against number one. You see, that kind of thing. But also whether there's anybody working on the depoliticization of the military in this field. And it speaks back to a long time when you had the apartheid government in the country, I'm told. It had an interest in unseating a government that was sympathetic to the liberation movement in South Africa, not to harbor them. So they needed a government that they want, so that if you force him to listen to the deal with you, bring it to the country or assassinate you, things like that. So the army then got used to being pushing this thing. Now, if you're not working with the army, you're not going to last as a politician. And it's now over many years. On South Sudan, why is President, and look, it's a new state that has been cast up around 2011, am I right? Why is President Salva Kiir refusing to sign the peace agreement with Riek Machar? I don't know what is this other formation there. But because what does it stand to gain? One would have thought that any president of any country would love conditions of peace so that he can construct government, he can develop, he can do all manner of things. But here is the president refusing to sign. What does it stand to gain? And what then are the possibilities? Does it mean that Riek Machar can then say to the world, look, he's not signing, and therefore I'm going back to the bush, I'm going to fight. Well, let me make then general comment. The quarter has just moved up. I wanted to say that while he makes a very good telling observation about corruption in some of the countries in Africa and other things that may be used by external forces, but obviously even forces within a country, to ultimately anticipate government. And sometimes by unconstitutional means, if there is no, you know, there's no voting, you know, you postpone election or you ban parties, etc., etc. Why that is true, it has happened in some of the states. But there are instances where external forces came in because they did not like the new president. Patrice Lumumba is a case in point. It was hardly 3 years in my view, 1960, 1961, 1962. He was assassinated. But the guy who came in, Mobutu Sese Seko, stayed for 30 years, and he was a dictator. And you see, so, and the world did say, but the president of that country is a dictator. He stayed with him to the extent that he gained mineral resources and all of those things. Now, world leaders sometimes do close one eye if it's their ally in charge of a country. And the other general comment I must make is whether as scholar yourself and in different research groups, you are accord, there is this one by Kweti Professor Tepis Kwakra, and then there is this one by Adibayo, RCCR and others, that analyze development, conflict, peacemaking, and all manner of things in the African continent, and then see what prognosis we have for the future. Whether you are invited by the leadership of the African continent in the AU, heads of state and government, and influential lawmakers like members of parliament, to say to them, this is how you, the African continent, looks like. And this is how you as a region, as Spanish, this is how you look like, as EAC, as Comesa, etc., etc. So, here are your fortunes, here are your weaknesses. Are they aware of this? So that even as they go about their political business, they are mindful of this. For instance, you were saying that the young and booming population is good for market, is good for big military, is good for other things, but if it is not skilled, is not given opportunities, if there's no capital, then it can be a result for instability forever. Is our leadership aware of this so that they always act in unity, at least, yeah. And are they aware that this may disturb Agenda 2063? But on the other side, I just want to join Mosal. I have my own suspicions, they may not be reasoned and informed, but yeah, that's very elemental observation. You see, if you want to, once you have come with Agenda 2063, and one of the influential countries in Africa, like South Africa, is part of BRICS, and there are clear signs that there is a shift in the economic balance of Africa towards the East. And if you look at the whole grouping, from Russia to China, India, etc., and you look at the population size, many other prospects. It could make the Western powers feel very insecure and very restive. And therefore, some of these things could be a product of that. But not limited to the African continent. The sanctions on Russia and other things that may be done on India or on China to ensure that they don't reemerge and challenge the hegemony, military, economic, etc. of the West. And lastly, I'm sorry, the chair is talking too much, giving himself too much time. Yeah, no, on the issue of the National Party, I have shared that story with many others. And I said, it is the only witness is that they were doing it only for the whites, to the disadvantage of South Africa. The white economic empowerment, it did not even start 1948, from 1910. So, you see, the Prime Minister was always white, male, and Afrikaner, and only could come in if the Brother Bond said yes to this one. From 1910, so it's about 88 years that they were there, up to 1994. Foxcraft is not after 1948. It's from 1915 it was established as a response to the bank that they thought was too English or was English, but less than, like old mutual, they said, now we must get our own. Sunlam, Dredd, Stas Bond, and many others. To the extent that they were doing this for the Afghaners, in fact, it is very marvelous. You said they gave skill,
capital and opportunity. But if they did for the entire South Africa, we would have been reached very far.
Yeah. Okay. So, any responses? You may not respond to everything, and then we want to get into the next question. How about you, Lato?
I think we're
done to
take a 1 minute break.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, really. Okay. Are there any, can I have one or two comments before we go to them? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what happened to were able to do acid in Syria. In the extraction of chemical weapons. Maybe what happens is they are not very sensitive to do the same in some of these areas because it's not just hot spot now, they are becoming infected instead of. Now, yeah, because now that we were able as South Africa to act in the extraction of those chemical weapons of Syria. Yeah. Now I don't know what is happening now because it seems that it's now things are good and Western Western. That is dreadful.
We'll ask Kalyan. Yes, Kalyan? Your hand is not up.
No, I was just explaining to the Honorable Maxson that my problem was I can't see on the screen. The light
is on.
Yeah, but I had an accident and my vision is affected. So I have to have it in hard copy.
Yeah.
But that by when I couldn't see it, I would then just close my eyes and listen. But you have to be very mindful of people with disabilities. It doesn't matter that I have glasses, I still can't see what's on the screen.
Okay.
You know, my Matuta has got glasses and you still can't see, but you have it in front of you. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I missed that first presentation because, you know, you can't see.
Okay.
You've got to be mindful of the disabilities.
Okay. Ambassador Kalia. Okay, so we have a bit of a 1 minute break. Can I come back and just say something about the continent? I think no, not about the continent, about the committee. Sorry. I'm happy that most of you have said that this information is very useful. Not only for us as committee members to debate in the House, but even when we speak to our communities, when we speak to young people, what opportunities are there, what weaknesses are there, and opportunities beyond the borders of South Africa. That if you've got a particular skill, in fact you are a resource for the whole continent, or a resource for the whole world. You could move with the skill from one continent to another or from one country to another if it is a scarce skill. So I think the information is quite very useful. We want to defer to you now for a response and then we take the last item. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Chair. Let me start by saying Sweden. There is a very interesting series on TV now. I think it just ended, but you can get copies of it, maybe download it and watch it. It's called Vikings. It's a very interesting series called Vikings. I watched all of it. My son downloaded it for me, and I watched it in a couple of weekends. I just sat and watched it. Why? Because I wanted to understand how did they come from being such a violent society to being the peaceful society they are today. And when you look at this writing, it makes ISIS look like a small tea party. Because the butchering that went on in that Viking movie. Violent. It's very violent. The things they did there. Now, it was a process of evolution, and it was tribes, basically. It was tribes that they were conquering. The Vikings went as far as Britain, conquering, and butchering, and raping, and doing all sorts of things. It was part of the formation of nations and uniting of tribes and bringing together nations. And it took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before they arrived at where they are today. So this Africa, we have had that process interrupted many times. It was interrupted by colonialism. It was interrupted by the Cold War. That process of nation formation and wars and other things that led to nation formation. So what we are witnessing now is not a new thing. It's just something that was put a lid on, and now it has emerged again. And so we are seeing this kind of nation formation that is going on the continent. Of course, we are not in the 1400s and 1500s and the 21st century, so we have better ways of dealing with it. But that they will happen is something we have to be realistic about. They will happen there. So that's the first point. The second point is I think the grievances are genuine grievances that are there. Unemployment, inequality, poverty, lack of basic services, the unequal provision of services, the unequal distribution of national resources, whether it is oil or whatever, to different communities based on identity, based on political reason, based on whatever. Those things are there, and they exist. And they are attributed to deficiencies. Honorable Mosala, I want to just repeat what I said because you raised that question also. That the grievances we have, they're genuinely there. Unemployment, poverty, inequality. And they relate to our own deficiencies in governance and in all sorts of things. And it has to do, as I said, with the unfair distribution of national resources, the selective distribution to different identity groups, political affiliations, patronage, all sorts of things that are there. But it happens, it's also happening in the middle of two global phenomena that is happening. One is a global economic competition that's taking place. And the other is a global political ideological competition that is taking place. So the political ideological one is around the clash between Judeo-Christianity on the one side and Islam on the other side. But largely fundamentalist Judeo-Christianity on one side and fundamentalist Islam on the other side. For superiority of such a value system, the Judeo-Christian is linked largely to the free market economy system, etc. Now remember that now I shall speak from Russia. Whether it's Russia, whether it's China, the former Marxist, now socialist state, and capitalism, that division is somehow blurred today. So even Russia has embraced a lot of free market economy policies. China is also so the economic ideological economic balance is not there now in the differences. They more or less all embrace the same thing. They are in different stages of embracing a free market economy and how that operates. It might be still commandist in some instances like China, might be less commandist in Russia, but completely unregulated in the U.S. laissez-faire economic system. But they're all more or less. Now they're competing amongst each other for dominance of that economic sphere, partly driven by the fact that they're all having the potential to rise in different ways. It's around energy, largely around energy, because energy is crucial to driving whatever else you want to drive. Now, the U.S., having discovered so much of shale gas and gaining energy self-sufficiency to a large extent, has changed the configuration. It's dropped the oil price by 50%, but it has not yet taken Europe out of its energy crisis, because Europe is still largely dependent on the Caucasus for its oil and gas, the Caucasus, mainly Russia. So the conflict now between NATO and all of that today, and then China rising as a power, and China wanting to ensure that it has a strong foothold in the South Sea. So no one going to dominate China in that thing. So that the securing of maritime territory, the building of those things in artificial land masses that they're building, and building all those air bases and all of that is to secure that. So we are caught in this large conflict as Africa. We are caught firstly in this economic competition. So make no mistake that the powers that be, whoever are fighting, want to see governments that are favorable to their interests. And they're going to do anything to do that. They'll fund NGOs, they'll fund this, they'll fund whatever to ensure that they can get a favorable government in place that will allow them to, because Africa is a center for strategic mineral resources for development today and development in the future, because it has also strategic mineral resources that will determine the space race. And there is a space race. So Africa has those. We in South Africa also. We have $2.3 trillion worth of minerals sitting here. This is not us who have said that. This is Goldman Sachs who have said it. $2.3 trillion here. We have oil resources sitting on our continental shelf also. So we are a prime country also. So the political developments here do not be without external interference. Make no mistake about it. It will not be without external interference to ensure that there's control. So there is this large macroeconomic war that is going on, and Africa is in the middle of all of that, because we present a market for raw materials. We also present a market for consumers in the future. If this market is being, you can't just produce, you have to produce and you have to sell somewhere. So that's the one. But we are going to see huge changes taking place. In the U.S. with its energy self-sufficiency is going to pull back manufacturing into the U.S. And that is going to affect China, because China's largest market is the U.S. And if they are manufacturing themselves, if they have started to manufacture cars and televisions and radios and whatever, all of those things, cell phones and everything, they start manufacturing them again in the U.S., they change balance again.
Yeah.
So there are lots of new developments that are going to take place. The second macro issue we are dealing with is this political ideological issue between Judeo-Christianity and Islam, Islamic fundamentalism on the other side. And there, even those who are competing are united on some level. They're united on some level and they're divided on some level. So they're divided on the economic competition, but they're united on that issue. Because Russia has an Islamic fundamentalist problem. China has an Islamic fundamentalist problem. The U.S. has created one everywhere. So it has a bigger problem. It reshaped for whatever reason there were plans that they had to reshape the Middle East. And now it has become an uncontrolled no man's land. A dormant conflict between the Sunnis and the Shias has become a huge issue. So you've got Iran on the one hand, together with Syria and Hezbollah and Hamas on that axis. And then you've got Iraq, which is now Shia, although that has joined in there. Then you've got the Sunnis on the other hand, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, of course, which is aligned somehow. That's why the NATO feared that Turkey would not be attacking ISIS, they'd be attacking the Kurds, thinking that things are going to attack ISIS. So it might also be a battle, what we are seeing, this battle between Judeo-Christianity and Islam. Within Islam, you are seeing a battle between the Shia and the Sunni, and then within the Sunni, you are seeing a battle between the fundamentalists and the moderates. And so, you know, if you say in Somalia, the Turks are there, and the Qataris are there, and then Al-Shabaab is aligned to ISIS. So it's a battle between the moderates and the fundamentalists played out in Somalia also. And it's backing now the Somali government. We know about what is happening. There's a group of Western-trained Somalis who have been handpicked in the traditional federal government. And they have now been deployed in the provinces, so they become almost like the governors in the provinces. They're all Western trained, etc., and they're placed in there to counter the fundamentalists. Whether it's going to work or whether it's not going to work. So we are caught up in this broad problem that is going on there. Now, Chair, what you are correct is, do our leaders all understand what this problem is? And the speed at which we have to go. Why do we have to go? I mean, we can carry on with this conflict, you know, because part of our problem is the disunity on the continent. Our leaders conflict with each other also. They also compete with each other for the markets, and they compete for the investments, and so we allow ourselves to be exploited and divided and all sorts of things, you know. So that is another problem that we are facing on the continent, how to unify the continent. Then comes Agenda 2063, which every country we hope will buy into Agenda 2063, because Agenda 2063 is looking at this opportunity of the young people that we will have. Now, how to create this economy? So the first is industrialization. How do we industrialize rapidly? Industrialization requires infrastructure. Infrastructure requires energy. So they are all tied together. So the first thing is energy. We need the energy to be able to extract all those raw materials, to be able to build the industry, etc. Now a lot of those things are happening. And they are happening with Chinese partners, they are happening with Russian partners, Indian partners, American partners, French partners. They're all on the continent, and so we are having to settle all of these things. In the meanwhile, we have our own little problem going over that we have to deal with. We're a hegemon in Southern Africa. Angola is a rising hegemon in Southern Africa. It's got the economic clout in terms of its economy, it's militarizing itself. Zimbabwe will account for 25% of all diamond outputs in the world. If they're guessing that, you know, Nigeria wants to assert itself as the largest economy. So that's unnecessary in a way. Because we should be sitting down as a continent and saying, how do we now take this opportunity? Where's the data for us? The danger is if we get caught in this thing and conflict with each other, and we have this proliferation of conflicts in the next 2 decades. In that time, our population will have increased. And if we had not solved the problems and taken care of the population, we'd be sitting with the problem in 2 decades from now. Because we will have now not 1.2 billion people to deal with, we'll have 2 billion to deal with. And they're not employed, and we don't have housing, and we don't have sanitation, and all of that. And we'll be in a mess, and we will mortgage the whole continent. Because those in power will find the problem so insurmountable, and that they'd rather just get into their little palace there, and then, you know, find a multinational corporation, trade with the multinational corporation for extraction, take the money, put it into a Geneva account,
buy a little out, and when the ship is there, just jump on a plane and go out and forget the rest of the thing, you know. So there is that possibility. Now let me tell you, that is happening to an extent. It's happening, you know, in places like the DRC and others. It's because people have the short-term view. Someday I don't know what is going to happen, and this is a big problem. Let's leave a big problem aside. So, you know, there's so many people every year, more and more people, you know, you can, and these are all mere mortals, you people. Not me, I'm sitting here giving you analysis. You people, you are legislators. Now when I present you with this headache of a problem, you know, you can either sit there and say, let's get around the table, how do we solve the problem? Or you can say, shoot, there's a big problem. You know, how am I going to deal with this problem? You know, I mean, I went to Juba for the independence of South Sudan. I said, how do you even start anything like this? I had a wonderful experience. 3 weeks ago, I was in Botswana, and it was President Masira's 19th birthday. So I couldn't make his birthday, and I arrived 4 days later for a static meeting. And I wanted to see him just to pass my congratulations on his 90th birthday. And he was very gracious, because I worked closely with him in the DRC conflict. And he said, no, I'm taking you to dinner. And just the two of us went to dinner. And we sat for 3 hours. And he was explaining to me how they started the Botswana post-independence, with nothing. 8 tribes. That's all they had, 8 tribes that were there. They had to unite the 8 tribes, and how they found this farm called the Nazre Kadron that was not occupied by any tribe. Then how they cut the tribes down and they said, look, we don't have anything, but should we find anything, let's agree today. It doesn't belong to whoever's territory it is in. It belongs to the nation and will share it equally for everybody. So, but they did that before the diamonds were discovered. Once the diamonds were discovered, there was already this agreement to say, let's share for everybody. And then he explained how they set up an infrastructure development fund, an investment fund, an education fund, all those things, you know. It was a fascinating story. In fact, I told him I want to invite him to address some people here, just to sit down and listen to the history of how they did this thing. You know, a fascinating story about how they created that. But I can only imagine that here was the Selsikama and the Masira and others in this desert, basically. And you can imagine sitting there with no money saying, how do we build a country? So now go, you know, it's like Burundi or one of these places. How do you exit? Somalia. Tomorrow you should take over. How do you solve Somalia? Libya. If you go to Libya tomorrow, how do you actually reconstruct Libya as a country? And I was saying to the American ambassador in Addis Ababa after Obama's speech, who was sitting there, I said, you know, even if take Obama and put him to run Libya, he can't run Libya. Because he's in a structured environment called the United States. So too are we in a structured environment called South Africa. We have a parliament, look at this. We take all this for granted. And then we make pronouncements on other people say, why can't they solve the problem? Well, go try and solve the problem. It's not that easy. So these are the realities, you know, that we have to deal with. So here, let me just quickly try to see. 2063 is a reasonable time. I'm optimistic. I think we will see lots of conflict in this time. We all have to be here. We are sitting down and saying, as an institution, let's try to find creative ways to solve this problem. Let's not sit back and say there are problems we can't do anything. Let's sit and say, how can we solve this problem? What can we do to assist our leaders as they begin the infrastructure development and other things? Let's put our minds together and think about these things. We get access to the power that we. I'm speaking for ourselves as an institution. Of course, I just addressed the Peace and Security Council 2 weeks ago, an early warning, and I spent quite a bit of time with them, their open session and their closed session. I traveled from there to Haron to address Tariq's parliamentary electoral forum. We go in 3 weeks time to Angola, where we are co-hosting with the African Union, and I will facilitate the 2 days of the Pan-African Panel of the Wise. So all the panels of the Wise, coming from SADC, ICAD, etc., we are all coming together in Angola, hosted by the Angolan government. And then there will be a large launch
of a peace initiated by the Angolan government. And then a month later, we are in Namibia for the special envoys meeting of the African Union, which brings all the special envoys of the African Union together on an annual basis. And we co-host as a cause with the African Union that also, so we get to present. This time the one in Namibia will be on terrorism and insurgency. So the discussions are going to be around that. We get to present in the UN, and we are presenting a lot to individual governments and others now on these problems, trying to alert them to what the challenges are that they have to face. And unfortunately, I mean, I have to say, with a lot of governments also, they have not seen the bigger picture and the problem. They are so caught up in crisis managing their own situations on a day-to-day basis. And largely this has to do with internal political competition. And I hope we don't get sidetracked here. I have to say as a South African, I get very worried with you people in Parliament. Because when I look at the problems and I see these big problems, and then you are all... Now, I don't want to be judgmental on any political party, but there are more urgent issues we have to deal with as a country. Big issues. The World Bank report released 2 days ago on youth in the country. These are the issues that we have to deal with as a country. And as legislators, you have to create that environment for a lot of these things to happen also. And I worry sometimes about the seriousness with which we understand the problems that are going on, and that we can't be, on international relations, for example. The thing about the United States is that they agree, they can fight inside, but they agree outside. They have one strategy of how to deal with the world. Now maybe on Iran they a little bit have a problem on how they're dealing with Iran. But generally, you know, there might be a Democrat and Republican inside the U.S., but the American outside. Now, yes, order. We have to move to that stage where you can be ANC or EFF or DA inside, but you're South Africa outside. On foreign policy, national interest. We have to know that, you know, every party has a right, because philosophically and ideologically you might have different ways of how the economy should be run and how things should be run, etc., etc. From the extreme left to the extreme right, there's any number of configurations there. You have a right to that. But there is a national interest, which is all our interest. It's not an ANC interest. It's not an EFF interest. It's not a DA. It's not an IFT interest. This is a South African interest. Education is a South African interest, and water, and sanitation, and housing. And these are our interests, and securing our democracy, and making sure we have an independent judiciary, and making... See, this is our interest as a nation. And that interest is tied to how we resolve our issues outside. So, we have to have one mind about how we will do that. That's my parting shot.
Yeah, we actually at the... the University of Johannesburg, facilitated by Professor Lanzar of the institution. What is it called, Mother? Yeah. There was a discussion, I think it came from one of the members of the South African Council on that will not have a discussion, but I don't think it will be limited to this portfolio committee or certain structures, about what constitutes national interest. So that South Africans are agreed upon this. But also, the other time, Honorable Mokalapa also spoke about that. That there must be these things about South Africa that constitutes national pride. When you are in America, you are in any other country, you say, no, we the South Africans on this one, still the following way. And it must be beyond our political parties, beyond our religions, beyond our ethnic groupings, beyond our languages. All of these other things must just be small things. Okay, thank you. Are you done?
No,
I don't
unless somebody wants me to answer anything.
No, we're fine. Okay. Thank you very much. Now, there is an item that has been which did not serve in the agenda, and it was requested for by Honorable Kalyan. And the background to this item was that in the wake of the visit of the President al-Bashir, there was a crisis following the court case led by the South African Litigation Center. And after that, there was a request by Honorable Mahalapa that we have a discussion about this matter. We could not because we said it was actually care at that time. And last week, Wednesday, we had requested the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, therefore, to present on the matter. And again, the Deputy Minister said, look, the matter is still up to the care. And he stuck to that position. And after that, the Honorable Khalapa then said, we must obtain a legal opinion around this matter. And we did refer this matter to the Parliamentary Advisory or Legal Services for an opinion. Now, the matter is now serving before us here. I want to allow Honorable Kalyan to speak to that matter. And then I will then read the letter that we have written to the Parliamentary Legal Services. So, as a person who asked for his presentation, I must be fair to you. I was just giving a short background. Over to you, Honorable Kalyan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be quite brief. Yesterday during the parliamentary session, the issue of the sub judice rule came before Parliament again. In last week's meeting, I had advocated that the sub judice rule does not prevail. I had said that the sub judice rule does not prevail, and that the Deputy Minister should give his presentation, and his interpretation was the matter is before the court and therefore he cannot comment on it. The rules of Parliament and the ruling by Judge Cheapers says that that rule, sub judice rule, does not apply to us. Notwithstanding, yesterday there was a long discussion, and at the end of it all, it was agreed that if a matter is before the court, it does not necessarily mean that we cannot discuss it in committee. The argument last week was that there was a judgment pending. The matter has since, the judgment has since been reserved, which means now there's no pending, we're not going to affect the material outcome, and therefore I'm requesting that we recall the Deputy Minister to present the item that was on the agenda last week with regard to the al-Bashir matter. And just as an additional information, I had suggested to Mukhalaba to ask you to get the legal opinion. But just as a matter of interest, last night we received a letter from the Speaker, we as in the DA, received a letter from the Speaker with regard to the motion of impeachment that we had put on the table in respect of President Zuma's handling of al-Bashir's matter. She had disallowed it last week, but last night we got a letter to say that her legal opinion or her advice was incorrect and she's now going to allow it. In view of the fact that the motion may come before the House within the next 2 weeks for the debate, I think it's important for us to get Circle's view on the matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who has got this letter? Andy, can you distribute? I said make copies for me to distribute to the Honourable Member. So that when I read the letter, they read with me.
Yeah.
The surviving that has been distributed, I also just want to say, perhaps it might be worthwhile getting the recordings of Hansard from yesterday, in particular the proposal by Minister Fando that the subjudicate rule should actually be removed from Parliament's rule.
Okay, are we all covered? Wow, Honorable Dudley. Now, we have some little difficulty acceding or not acceding to the request you are making, Honorable Talia. Because following the request by Honorable Mokarafa that he did not agree with the Deputy Minister that he is bound by the subsidiary rule, he then said, let's get our own legal opinion. Now, we have written a letter to the legal service to give us that opinion, and that opinion has not yet been given. So we're still waiting for that opinion, and the matter has been brought before us again. Why are we still waiting for the opinion? Just want to read the letter to you, dated the 13th, which was the following day, the 13th. Now, the second paragraph. The committee resolved that a legal authority can be removed. Just want to read the second paragraph. Okay. Others don't have it. Okay. The Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation held a meeting yesterday, which was the 12th, to receive a briefing from DERCO on the participation of President al-Bashir in the African Union Summit held in South Africa on the 7th to the 6th of June 2015. Deputy Minister Lenda, who was scheduled to do the presentation first to the committee, could not present on the topic as the matter is adjudicated. The committee resolved that a legal opinion be sought on whether the Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation may request a briefing from the department whilst this matter is before the court and whether the adjudicated rule applies to the Portfolio Committee. That's where we were, that's what we said last week. And then yesterday, another letter was written to the legal services. Let's leave the first one. It says, the committee resolves that a legal opinion... Oh, no. The last one. The chairperson is requesting urgent response on the matter as he intends to table it for discussion in the committee meeting tomorrow. So if you understand what I'm trying to say here, is that a member said, let's get our own legal opinion different from what the department is saying. And then we wrote a letter the following day. And then yesterday, and then we wrote this letter so that we could prepare for today. Now the reason why you didn't have this item here today is because they were not ready with the legal opinion. Now when you bring this request, here, Honorable Kalia, and that opinion which has been sought by this committee from Parliament, now not from DERCO, from Parliament, is not before us. It means then the committee is now putting the proverbial horse before the cart. All the cart before the horse. Yeah, but I'm aging. Yeah. So we just have a bit of a problem there, and can I just hear what the members are saying? You have this letter dated the 13th, you have this letter dated yesterday. Now you have a member saying, let's put this thing aside, when in fact we have requested an opinion. And that opinion is still on the way, and we don't know what that opinion will say, which has been requested by us. I want to hear. Members, I'll start with Raleigh Khoma, followed by May Green, let me write it down. Honorable Raleigh Khoma, and then May Green, and then Mo Maila, and then Rafuti, and then Charlie. In that order, please. Over to you.
Okay. It's quite interesting because we have just discussed or the same of national interest. And now we are discussing this. But I'm fine. It's just that the in terms of yesterday's proceedings, there was no decision. The interim, when we continued, was still to await the legal opinion on the same matter. We continued, but the summary was that we must still await the legal opinion of substitute rule.
I just want to say that because now we are waiting for this legal opinion, let us just wait. We'll just wait our member here, just to wait a little bit. Because I must also mention that, Chair, I'm very grateful of you because you didn't use your power as a chairperson. When he raised the matter of Al-Fakir, you seek a legal advisor. And then now, she's raising that matter because of what happened yesterday, all we did. As the FF were challenging Rule 67, and then the Parliament decided to forge ahead. And now we're stuck with this matter here. So now I think it's very easy just to say, let us wait for the legal opinion, because we have to know where are we standing as Parliament in terms of that Rule 67. It's clear as that.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mayela.
So I think Honourable Halim is pretty specific that maybe we not pursue a matter there. But mine was to say, let's do by what we agreed on last week. And as to the proceedings yesterday, there was no decision that was reached. The DA had their own understanding of the subjudice principle that doesn't exist because one judge once made a pronouncement, which is not what we understand. So we stand by, let's seek a legal opinion for Jay. Thanks.
Another word,
Rakuti. Yeah, on the issue of the national interest, I'm applying on the issue of the national interest, Chair, and the issue is still sub judice, and we are not going to entertain the Chairperson's attention. Another
Rakuti.
Thank you, Chair. I just thought that we may need clarity because in the meeting today it was said that the DA had called for a debate of the debate. I just thought perhaps the letter that Honourable Cullen referred to was saying that we were going to debate it in the House. And if we were, whilst we do want this opinion from the state law advisor, and that's important, maybe we should still request BIRCA give us whatever information they think that we need in view of the fact that there is going to be a debate in the House. So my thought was there's two, because together two different issues. We do need the information from the state law advisor, but we also need BIRCA to know we're going ahead with a debate in terms of what you received from Parliament. Therefore, we're giving them an opportunity to bring that information to us. I think it's only fair for them and for us.
Yeah, there are two things that I suspect you just a little bit conflated. You see, the court said through the decision maker, we can't explain the circumstances leading to the leaving of President Al-Bashir of the country because we are responding to the court and therefore this matter is not to care. That's the their proposition and then we stop them. Then Mukhalafa said, we as a committee, now we want our own legal opinion whether, while that matter is in, you have to respond to the court, whether we as members of parliament can't discuss as parliament, we're not court. And now we as this committee have asked for a legal opinion. Why are we waiting for the matter served here today, you see? So if I can persuade ourselves, our good self, I would say that let the legal opinion for us as parliament, this committee, which must advise parliament, no matter what Berko is saying to us, that look, yes, you can proceed, you can do that, you can do that, then we have it in writing, we distribute it to ourselves here, and on the basis of that, then we can engage Berko and say, we have been told that this matter is only binding on you as the executive, not to us. Or we can say, yes, we have to wait, because the subsidiary rule binds everybody. It binds the executive is buying parliament. You see, but let's have a written opinion. That's the position I would have given to ourselves. I will agree, and thank you very much. And the next thing is, again, Siyabonga.
Yeah,